Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
You've heard him on the Drew and Mike Show, and now he's back. Join us at Wise Guys Comedy Club of Novi Thanksgiving Week as we present the Rich Guzzi Psychohypnosis Show. Check out myspace.com/RichGuzzi to view clips of previous shows. Comedy will never be the same.
Phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us and joining me in the WRIF studios, Jolene Jordan. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
You know, I didn't clear this with you. So
you didn't?
No, so I'm going to take a chance.
Okay.
You're worried, aren't you?
Well, sometimes you worry me. Usually not.
You're going to have a public performance soon. Can we talk about that?
Oh, yes,
okay.
We can.
Yeah. When, you're going to be playing? Give us the
details. Yeah, it's a couple weeks away, December 8th. It's a Saturday, and we're playing at the Monterey Music Cafe in Allen Park.
Oh, cool.
Going on about 8:30, and so we hope everyone comes out.
And you got a band, right?
I have a band. I have a really cool band. I hired some musicians from Lansing and got a guy, Tim Krukowski from Sponge.
Oh, good. He'll
be playing bass for me. Yep. And I have a real incredible picker from my hometown back in Iowa.
Really?
He'll be playing along. So, yeah.
Not your dad.
Not my dad. He's not coming to this one, though.
He is on the album. On Jordan album.
He's a heck of a guitar player.
Yeah. You can find Jolene's, both her MySpace page and what else?
Well, my website, I just don't even bother.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but myspace.com, Jolene Jordan Music.
Yeah.
Or you can go to peterwerby.com and you can find me there.
And you can't, it's lucky we didn't get married. Because if because you're relaxed for reasons, but you always have to spell your first name, right?
Yeah, J-U-L-I-N-E.
And I always have to spell my last name, W-E-R-B-E. So think if you were married and took my last name.
It would be really tough.
Yeah,
I probably wouldn't. It's not my nature to take the last name.
Yeah, well,
you know.
I know. It's
a very nice last name.
Or hyphenated.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happens when the kids with a hyphenated last name and then marries someone else with a hyphenated last name?
Wow.
They wind up with four names?
Yeah, I guess so.
And it could go on.
Pick one, choose one.
Yeah. Anyway, my website where you can find both stuff about me and the program and also Jolene's MySpace page is PeterWerby, W-E-R-B-E.com. If you'd like to call in to the talk show, it's 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Yeah. So, and by the way, I usually, in fact, my wife asked me, she said, how often do you change your website? And I said, daily. In fact, many times during the day.
Yeah,
and,
you're on it.
Yeah, and, you know, and part of the, I don't know if it's a problem, sort of a problem for me, because I always have, I enjoy it, actually. I enjoy putting all this stuff on it.
Yeah.
It's labyrinthine. Is that the word? Labyrinthine? Fine? Thum,
I'm not sure, but yeah, it's very large.
It's a labyrinth. Yeah. So when we're not here, Jolene and I sometimes we're forced to take a Sunday off. You can always go there and find a lot of the same stuff. Well, let's see. The name of the group was where? CQ Press, a unit of the Congressional Quarterly, has declared that West Bloomfield, Michigan, is the most dangerous city in the United States.
Okay, this is news to me. You're kidding, right?
No, I'm sorry. It's Detroit.
Okay. I did see that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're not from around here, and I know many of you are listening around the country and even around the world, West Bloomfield is a very, very upper middle class and wealthy district. A lot of the big richies in the area, sports stars, music stars live in these enormous mansions.
Enormous.
Yeah. They don't have much of a problem with danger out there, do they? I don't think so. So here, this is the article. Just came out. Another blow to the Motor Cities. Which Motor City? What a joke. The Motor City's tarnished image. In fact, where did that go? We'll be lucky if that even...
We beat St. Louis.
Yeah, we beat St. Louis. Yeah. Here, auto sales could hit 15-year low. Three top investors in the automotive industries painted a grim picture on Sunday for the sector in 2008, with one executive predicting a possible slump in U.S. sales to levels not seen in 15 years.
Mm.
But anyway, another blow to the Motor City's tarnished image. Detroit pushed past St. Louis to become the nation's most dangerous city, according to a private research group's controversial analysis. Some people were saying that it's like comparing watermelons and grapes. But the stats are, well, they're just saying that, you know, you've got all these raw statistics about crime. I forgot, the report looked at 378 cities and on a per capita basis, looked at the rates for homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and auto theft, and then put it all together and said Detroit was the crime leader. And, I mean, who says we're not number one?
That's
number
right.
One.
Number one. We're always up there anyway in the top three, aren't we?
We are. So then St. Louis, and then number three, Flint, Michigan.
Wow.
Where Michael Moore is from, Oakland, California, Camden, New Jersey, Birmingham, Alabama, North Charleston, South Carolina, Memphis, Richmond, and Cleveland. Mission Viejo, California, the safest U.S. city. I don't even know where that is. Southern California, I think.
It sounds safe.
Or Central or Northern, one or the other. But also Brick Township, New Jersey.
Is safe. Okay.
So, of course, and why I was being silly about saying it's West Bloomfield, that's a wealthy neighborhood, and Detroit is extraordinarily poor. So it shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, that's been the case since cities began. Mm-hmm. When you have a very poor, anytime you have a poor concentration of people, and I mean, usually if it's concentration, it's not going to be rural. So it's going to be cities. And going back even 1,000 years, 500 years, the big cities, in fact, as people left in Europe, as people left the rural areas, as agriculture was destroyed and people fled into the cities, they were just pits of crime besides disease and everything else. So as long as we have an economy where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, this should not come as a big surprise. And as I've always said, this is we're using here in the United States now the Guatemala model, which means about a third of us are going to be well-waged and we're going to be consumers and life will go on pretty much like it has, where the other two-thirds are going to be falling farther and farther beneath the standards that we used to call a middle-class standard of living. Here from the British Broadcasting News, BBC News, Americans are worried that hard times lie ahead, but in Detroit, Michigan, they've already arrived with a vengeance. Michigan, by some calculations, has lost 400,000 jobs in the last 7 years.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know. How are we still operating?
I don't know.
That's a lot. And the population's 10 million. Detroit is seeing unemployment, the BBC News says, running at nearly 8%, twice the national average. And I suspect, given most of the factors, that it could be 50% higher than that. In other words, around 10 or 12%. So that's depression levels. The number of homes in Detroit foreclosed is among the highest in the country. And just to give you an idea, I don't know exactly what it is in Detroit, but I was listening to some report, And they were saying that in that a year ago in Miami-Dade, which is also leading the U.S. in foreclosures.
And
that,
crime.
And crime. That a year ago, that there were 18,000 properties for sale in Miami-Dade County. This last week, it was 88,000.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Man, I don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like it is getting any better. Here, this article in the New York Times and the foreclosure crisis of 2007. Thousands of American families are losing their homes without ever missing a payment. They are renters in houses whose owners default on their mortgages. So, and things are getting so bad. Did you hear about this, Julene? The shooting of this one gas station owner shot to death another one?
I did hear about that.
They got in this huge brawl at this Marathon station in Springwells and Fort in southwest Detroit. And they had been having this price war. It's what's gasoline here now? $3.17 a gallon.
Sure, right
yeah.
there.
And but they had dropped it down to $2.93, and the Marathon guy had dropped it 3 cents less than BP. The discussion between the two owners quickly escalated into a fight, with two more people from the BP station brawling with rivals at Marathon.
Jeez.
One man was hit with a baseball bat in the melee. Then the police say the 51-year-old owner of the Marathon station pulled out a gun and shot the owner of the BP station, a 45-year-old man, father of five children. In a wild postscript, it appears the BP station took advantage of the shooting. While police were still swarming the Marathon station, the BP jacked up its prices. Owner's body was taken away, workers at the BP station changed the price per gallon of unleaded from $2.96 to $3.09.
Oh, what an awful story all the way around.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, hell in a handbasket, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was in downtown Detroit last night. We went to a restaurant on Harmony Park called Lola's.
Okay. Sort of
jazz spot, good food. My wife and I and friends, we went down there. And, you know, everything physically looks like it's going up. I mean, you know, it was all lit up and it had a big Christmas tree. People were skating in that, you know, I don't know, what do they call it?
Campus Martius?
Campus Martius. They don't call it CompuWare Park yet, huh?
No.
Campus Martius, good.
I don't think so.
And all the facades, I mean, there's not great occupancy down there, but all the facades have been redone of the building, so it doesn't look like a slum as it did 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
But remember, I read this last year, too. 1 out of 4 homeless are veterans. VA hospitals forced to turn away patients. What the hell is going on here, people? And you know... Like, I keep thinking about our circumstances, which isn't bad. We're not facing this. We're not, you know, and yet there's...
Either of us could be, though, you know? I mean, anyone at any time this could happen to.
And it's increasing. I mean, it creeps closer and closer to us. Starts at the, you know, the lowest ebb of society and then expands. So you have these foreclosures beginning to occur even in middle-class areas. And I was noticing... The other day, in some of these places like Pleasant Ridge and where else? Another middle class suburb where none of these properties are selling.
Yeah.
I think if you wanted to invest in anything these days, it would be in some company that manufactures for sale signs.
Yeah, something like that. I wouldn't be investing in homes and fixing them up, trying to sell them right now.
We're ready for 3 minutes hate. Everybody who remembers Orwell's 1984, they would show the face of Big Brother's enemy. Well, they would
scream and rage for 3 minutes at a time.
Right. And this case, of course, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He said that he was talking, there was a meeting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, that OPEC, the oil producing.
Is it Riyadh or Riyadh?
I don't know. You say. What does
I just try to get it right.
Yeah. OPEC. Oil producing. I forget what the hell it stands for. OPEC. It's the people that produce the oil, the association of these countries. President Ahmadinejad of Iran said OPEC's members have expressed interest in converting their cash reserves into a currency other than the depreciating U.S. dollar, which he called a worthless piece of paper. I can't begin to tell you, folks, what that would presage if that occurs. One of the reasons that Iran is the enemy of the United States is because the fear that he would, in fact, leave petrodollars and start having, like, petro-euros or something like that. I mean, that would set the United States into an incredible tailspin.
More than it already is.
Yeah, Well, I don't know if we're in a tailspin, but that
it
was...
It sure feels like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. His comments at the end of a rare summit of OPEC heads of state. The hardline. Yeah. Iranian leaders' comments also highlighted the growing challenge that Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil producer, faces from Iran and its ally, Venezuela, within the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. That's what OPEC is.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Ahmadinejad told reporters, they get our oil and give us a worthless piece of paper. So you're saying, wait a minute. I got my dollars. I got a bank account. I just spent money. Don't tell me they're worthless. Here's what's happening. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez echoed this sentiment Sunday on the sidelines, saying the empire of the dollar has to end. Don't you see how the dollar has been in free fall without a parachute, calling the euro a better option? Because as the dollar begins to lose value, if you're getting paid in dollars, you're getting less for what you've sold.
Right.
Like that, the what was that model's name from last week?
Giselle Bundchen.
Bundchen, my little Bundchen. My little Bundchen doesn't want to be paid in dollars anymore. She wants to be paid in euros. Now, I know there's a lot on the right wing. There's always been this agitation against the U.S. Federal Reserve System, which is this semi-private, semi-governmental agency that regulates currency. And here's what it's done recently. The U.S. Federal Reserve said Thursday that it had pumped 47.25 billion U.S. dollars into the nation's financial system to help ease tight liquidity. Now, you think, what the hell? I just read Doug Henwood's incredibly important and informative Left Business Observer. He talks about business, finance, money, what have you, from a left perspective. And if you look at this, if you look at what he says, and then look at all the happy hoorah that what do they call them, the money honeys and all those, you know, those babes they got on television.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? All of a sudden they're that's all.
You got to have the look.
You got to have the look.
I guess.
Money honeys,
right.
Yeah. And then compare it to what's here. Although I'll tell you, it is not easy to understand. I mean, we're talking about a very, very complex crapshoot,
yeah,
which is the world economy.
Oh, yeah.
Partly it's totally out of control because, I mean, the Fed attempts to control it to some extent. I mean, these people that say, you know, we were a free nation until the Fed was established in 1913 and all that. I mean, there's been these enormous repressions, or I'm saying, that's a line from, what's that Christmas song, Cheech and Chong?
Oh, which one?
You know, Santa Claus and his old lady.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And his old lady.
And he says something about repression. He says, you mean recession? He says, oh, repression, recession. What's the difference, man? Well,
yeah.
So, yeah, repressions and depressions were occurring worse and worse from the 1890s through 1913. And the capitalists that were the main people in control of the economy just said, we've got to have some way to regulate this. So the extraordinarily deep ups and downs didn't occur. So this is what, I don't know what to say. I mean, I agree with some of the criticisms of the Fed, but if this money wasn't pumped in there, what the hell would have happened? The whole damn thing would have collapsed, right?
Yeah.
And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to manipulate this house of cards so there's not this catastrophic collapse like occurred in the 1930s or 1890s or these other panics and recessions and stuff that we've experienced. By the way, we are the people always that suffer. I mean, some of the biggies do. You know, remember, they always have this this image of 1929 of Black Monday, wasn't that it? Yeah, where there was a stock market collapse and these stockbrokers were jumping out of windows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about it, I mean, how many did? 40? No. 20? No. 10? No. I mean, there may have been a couple that committed suicide because they knew that this, you know, their house of cards had collapsed. Mainly, you know, the wealthy through that period, they had their big mansions and they had their big parties and they drove their big Cadillacs and Packards and Duesenbergs and what have you. So, the people that always get hurt, of course, are us, the middle class, the working class, and the poor. I don't know if the poor get hurt because they're usually screwed to begin with, right?
Yeah, that's true. All the way around.
Yeah. There are a couple of things in here. Let me see, though. I was looking for something showing that, here. What I do, I got all these, you're just sitting back and letting me rave, aren't you?
Yeah, the economy thing, that's your baby.
Yeah, because ultimately, because what have we talked about nonstop about the last 4 years is the war in Iraq, right?
Yeah.
It still goes on, the slaughters still go on, the money, well, here.
And longer than 4 years.
Oh, yeah, that's right. March, yeah, so it'll be 5 years this coming March. Well, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars could cost the United States $3.5 trillion through 2017 if the hidden costs like higher oil prices, care for wounded soldiers, and interest on borrowed money are counted. Because remember, we're borrowing all this, folks.
That was the number that astounded me was, well, not only the dollar amount, but reading 2017.
Yeah, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
The new report assumed the United States would withdraw about half of its present combat troops from Iraq by 2013 and maintain 75,000 soldiers in Iraq from 2013 to 2017.
And what is any of these candidates talking about getting the troops out? They are so full of baloney.
Yeah. Boy, you scared me there for a second.
You know better.
I mean, yeah. In another story on the same report, it says this figure translates into $21,000 for a family of four. That's what each of us are going to wind up paying. Now, when we talk about $3.5 trillion, again, it's not lost in the wash. We pay it through our tax money, and then somebody gets it. So it's not entirely just flushed out of the system. It actually gets circulated back. Through the system,
right. but not into the necessary programs.
Yeah, not where we'd like. Yeah, not where we'd like. It's Bush's buddies. It's the war makers, essentially. And this is war Keynesianism. John Maynard Keynes was an English economist who said that the economies could not go without stop facing these constant repressions. Yeah, there I go again. Recessions could not stop facing these recessions and depressions unless there was mammoth government spending. And he visualized it on the basis of social expenditures. And what it really has come about in modern capitalist economies has been war expenditures to the point where we now have a war economy 24/7 to come.
Yeah, across the board.
Yeah, across the board. And that's what the economy is based on. So we work, and essentially what we do is finance this enormous war machine. That's not even the most effective way. Even if you're interested just in promoting the economy, it's not the most effective way to spend our money if we wanted to do
that. I think you're putting that way too nicely.
Yeah, you're right. So I like this. What I've been saying is either we have to join a movement of resistance and renewal or thatch our roofs and get ready to be peasants, just like in the early 19th century or even like in the 17th century. And you're saying, okay, I'm ready for the movement of resistance and renewal. Where do I sign up, Pete? And that's what hasn't been devised yet. There's little beginnings of it. It's not like it's not there at all. It takes different forms, and it depends on your interest in actually joining it. So are you going to be a witness to history while other people make it? Or, in other words, put another way, are you going to be the object of history? You're an object to be worked upon by large forces that most of us feel are out of our control. Most people feel, you know, if you went up to our neighbors and say, do you think you can control the elite political system? They'd laugh. They say, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course not.
Yeah.
Do you think even more so? Do you think you can control the elite economic systems, which are actually interests, which are actually controlling the elite political system? And everyone would laugh in your face.
Yeah.
Because they know that it's impossible, right? Particularly as an individual. So what we try to do is try to eke out of all this it's happiness, some hopefully sense of reward in what we're doing economically or just
sanity,
yeah. And that's why a lot of people have just disconnected from the political system.
Because, absolutely.
Yeah, because it looks impossible for us to have any direct effect.
Yeah.
Because, one, it's run by elites, And two, to a large extent, it is completely out of even their control. Because it's not like it is. I mean, I talk about this pyramid and how these, you know, the elite ruling class at the top makes all the big decisions. But there's so many, countervailing powers within that that work for, like, just immediate gain, economic gain, that there's so much corruption, there's so much self-serving interest in it. And it has this this momentum that it just is like this huge juggernaut that it gets pushed into being, but then kind of runs over everyone in its path, and sometimes even people that thought that they were at the top of it all.
It's very true. I think it's also very overwhelming to people. It's also very confusing to people because there's so many mixed messages coming through the media, and then they run into someone who watches Foxhole News for a hobby. 24/7, and then they get this information, and they're completely confused.
I'm totally depressed. I really am.
I know. I'm feeling a little bummed out.
Nobody's even calling. 313-298-WRIF. Are you as depressed about all this as I am, or do you just think, oh, come on, man, lighten up. It'll all be okay.
But it won't be.
I'm going to tell you really a bad story.
Oh, no. Is it getting, you mean it's going to get worse?
No,
are we going to be more depressed?
I'm
going to
tell you stuff that's even worse, not even economically, but in a second. I saved this stuff from a month ago or so about the income inequality gap is widening and how much control this economic elite has, that the world's millionaire club is now, there's only, in the whole world, there's 10 million millionaires.
Mm.
There's 6 billion people or so.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But there's all these things that you find. So while we're talking in Detroit or in Northville or in Allen Park or someplace like that, that there's all these economic problems, that people are losing medical insurance, their pensions are going south, they're losing their jobs.
Losing their homes.
Yeah. Charles Hack, a New Yorker, he just bought a stamp for $850,000, for his little stamp collection.
What?
Yeah. They have this,
oh, my gosh.
There's this 1918 24-cent airmail stamp where they put the design upside down, this airplane on it, and there's only like 100 of them in existence. So I want to have that for my little collection.
Oh, my God. That's so repulsive.
Yeah. How about this, though? Because this guy didn't have as much money. But a rare and pristine poster for the 1935 movie Bride of Frankenstein, starring Boris Karloff, was sold Wednesday by the Heritage Auction Galleries of Dallas for $334,000.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah. So somebody just bought it.
Yeah.
Soaring compensation for university presidents, once limited to a few wealthy institutions, is becoming increasingly common, with the number of million-dollar pay packages at private institutions nearly doubling.
It used to be that the college president really didn't make that much, in the scheme of things, that much money, but it's like it's out of control there as well.
But, well, hey, they earned it.
Oh, yes. They're running an entire university, you know.
How about this guy? Yeah. I mean, I'd go run U of M for a cool $300,000.
Right on.
In a heartbeat. Yeah. What do they? They just go, no, no, yes, no. Yeah. And then they go off to a luncheon.
Yes.
And they get $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
This is what we're talking about, where, oh, boy, I can't even remember what portion of the world's population lives on what. But it's low, folks. And I think, half the population of Mexico, our neighbors to the south, our North American neighbors, half the population lives on $5 a day or less.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, by the way, the dollar has so devaluated that Bill Gates is no longer the richest man in the world.
He's not.
Señor Slim.
Oh.
The man from Mexico who owns everything.
Okay.
In Mexico.
Who owns Mexico?
Yeah,
who
owns Mexico. But he is way outdone by this guy. In the annals of excess, it could be a new high. A more than $300 million supersized luxury airplane bought and outfitted solely for the private comfort of a Saudi Arabian billionaire.
Yeah, once, so he's a prince, isn't he?
Yeah, Prince Walid bin Talal, He bought an Airbus A380.
I've never even heard of one of those, first of all. And it's 6,000 square feet?
Yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't include outfitting.
Please.
It doesn't include outfitting. He's going to have private bedrooms, a movie theater, or a gym with a jacuzzi.
Yeah. And 15 people need to run it.
Ben Talal. And get this, he's the Citigroup in Inc.'s biggest individual shareholder and the 13th richest person in the world, $20 billion. And even buying these things, he can't afford, you know, he can't spend all the money he has. So he's hogging all this money where people are just, you know.
Eking by.
Eking by.
Yeah, and think of all the people right now. The holidays are coming up, and how many people are sitting there listening to you tell that story, and they're sitting there at home going, how in the hell am I going to buy my son the, you know, whatever hot game it is, or, you know, anything? Maybe a small gift may even be too much for a lot of people this year.
This guy owns, has stakes in Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Raffles Hotels International, Time Warner, PepsiCo, and Walt Disney, just to name a few. He's in his 50s, and he already has a private 747-400.
Well,
he's into it. It's like buying a new car or a new TV. One wants something bigger and better, says somebody, whoever the hell this is. I'm not even interested in.
Sounds like a path to unfulfillment to me, but
yeah,
call me crazy.
Yeah, but, you know, there is this thing. Did you see that? That in you know, Saudi Arabia is our ally. We give them billions of dollars. Why don't we give them billions of dollars? They have billions of dollars. Why don't they give us billions of dollars?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know?
But, oh, man, did you see this, though? They're going to whip this woman who was gang raped?
No.
I mean, I know you can't believe this.
In Saudi Arabia?
In Saudi Arabia, yeah. She was
our friends.
Yeah, she was gang raped by.
Yeah, so that's what happens in countries like this, where if a man does something against a woman, a group of men rapes a woman, and then she is shunned and now is going to be whipped for it. Yeah. It just incenses me completely.
They're actually whipping the guys, and you have to hold a Quran under your arm. And so, you know, so you can't get these, like, massive overhead whips so that, I mean, still, it's
extraordinary. While you're whipping, you hold the Quran?
Quran under your arm. Yeah. Hello.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, and where's the campaign to save this woman?
So we're talking about Iran as being these religious fanatics. For one thing, Saudi Arabia is the home of much, much greater religious fanaticism, and it is also less repressive than Egypt, which is, again, our ally who we give billions of dollars to. Tell me something good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Robert Fisk, The Great War for Civilization. I'm telling you, I'm learning so much in this book. Yeah. I'm up to page 95 out of 1,100.
Yeah.
It's a tough read, but if you really, really want to get a grasp on the Middle East in one really big-ass book, there you go.
You know, I was going to take a break, but I got to hear this. It's Anthony in St. Clair Shores. Anthony, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Well, you know what? You've very much confused me.
Oh, sorry.
You know, I agree with some things that you're saying, but it seems like you're talking in circles on stuff.
Well, it's all confusing stuff.
It's very confusing.
Yeah, and so it probably feels like circles.
It does feel like circles. Yeah. And I'm not very political.
What's that?
What I believe
he said
in.
He's not very political.
Oh, okay.
I'm not very political.
Yeah,
but
okay.
You guys are. I don't even know what my point was. I'm so confused listening to the rest of the stuff you talked about. I don't know what my original point was. Because I got so confused listening
sorry,
to everything
Peter.
You guys said.
I threw a lot of stuff out there at once. And
okay,
makes you
feel any better? I'm confused, too. Just kidding.
Well, I know. I said I was reading this Left Business Observer, and it confused me. But why do we have an economy that confuses us? Why isn't it simple? Why don't you and I and Jolene and everyone else listening, why isn't there work for everybody? Why don't we work, get money, and the money that we make, we use to spend, and the taxes go to stuff that we all need to make our country a good place to live. I mean, it shouldn't be confusing. But if you start, in fact, in this Left Business Observer, Doug Henwood was even saying he couldn't explain all of this stuff. I mean, he was talking about some of these little aspects of the subprime mortgage crisis. Yeah. And I was just looking for this one phrase here that I was, He says, it's gotten so that even this sort of securitization, see already, I don't want to explain that, seems innocent. In recent years, Wall Street's finest minds have packaged mortgages and other debts into complex, exotic securities, things with names like collateralized debt obligation. And he says, this isn't the place to explain exactly what those are. So
please do.
Yeah, well, he says, suffice it to say that a lot of supposedly sophisticated investors who've bought these beauties don't even know what's in them.
Oh, great.
So we're talking about a system that's out of control. And it's, well, and usually when people say that, they mean it's just kind of bad situation. But think about that in real precise terms. We're living in an economic system that's out of control. Why isn't it in control? All right, Anthony, let me say one thing, too. This is a show of a real unique character, particularly for commercial radio. Usually people deal with very, very extraordinarily simple messages. And there's nothing that I was saying that that had that quality. It was probably too much information for radio. But I don't know what else to do. I mean, I don't know how else to present it.
Well, I think with a topic such as this, maybe there's not another way.
Okay. Thank you, Anthony. I'm sorry. I turned my own mic off. Thank you. That tells you something. Hey, we got some open lines. You got something simple and happy to say? We'd love to hear it.
Or not.
We'll talk about skiing at Telluride when we come
right,
back.
Okay.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
313-298-WRIA.
313-298-9743.
The one thing out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The vlogs.
The special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sick. Sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. And joining me, Julene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
I asked her to say it a little slower.
And it's not because you thought I was really saying it too fast. You heard another host who just rambled through it, and you thought, slow down.
Yeah, don't you ever get that? You know, your answering machine, you say, hi, this is Peter. Give me a call back at 313-298-743. And you go, what the hell?
I always repeat it twice and slowly, yes. Mm-hmm.
Talking some about the economy and the falling dollar and the effect that it's going to have on all of us here. Jacob, listening in Oulu, Finland. That's right, the country, Finland. He writes, Indian tourist sites in India, including the Taj Mahal, are refusing to accept dollars in payment for entry fees.
Really?
Yeah. All right.
Just another story of that.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, hi. It's Peter and Julie.
Hi. How are you both?
We're doing great.
Wonderful.
You know, I'm surprised that you're not talking up Detroit. You are in the media, you know.
Yeah. Well, this is shocking, actually. I mean, particularly since I said I was downtown. I'm thinking, man, I love going downtown. And
we love Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're both brave.
Well, wait a minute. Don't you live in Hamtramck?
Yes.
Yeah. I was just there the other night.
I'd like to live there. Anyway, I was just going to say I was really impressed with the lawyers in Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're protesting and getting thrown in prison. And they really make our lawyers look like cowardly whores, basically. You know, they interviewed one of them, and they said that their medal was their integrity, not money.
Wow.
And you know, of all our lawyers, who do we look up to? Maybe Barry Scheck?
We all look up to
Do we
Barry
look
Scheck.
Up to... Okay.
I think we should.
I forgot. Wait a minute. I forgot who Barry Scheck is.
O.J. Simpson.
Oh, the Innocence Project.
And the Innocence Project. Well, look up to Barry Scheck.
Right.
And we interviewed him, Peter.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
You know,
it's been a while, sorry.
Washington in March, you know, when our country is defecating on our Constitution, you know?
It's an interesting image.
We go there.
Well,
they went to Washington, you know, to support the lawyers in Pakistan.
Okay.
Big deal.
Well, now, come on. Let's cut them some slack. On Tuesday, November 20th, coming right up, noon, down, let me see, at the McNamara Federal Building, Cass in Michigan, lawyers are marching to support the rule of law in Pakistan, and they say all are welcome to join us in a rally supporting the Pakistani lawyers and judges protesting the suspension of human rights in Pakistan. And it's supported by the National Lawyers Guild, the Detroit Metropolitan Bar Association, the ACLU, and the Criminal Defense Attorneys of Michigan.
Great.
So they're.
I'm not impressed.
I am. Why aren't you impressed?
Why don't they protest the civil rights violations in our country?
Well, they are. Well, wait a minute. First off, you're saying that the people aren't getting support for the Pakistani lawyers. They are. Certainly, the National Lawyers Guild, the far as I'm concerned, the foremost bar association, although it's not the largest in the United States, and certainly the ACLU, but a lot of even the more conservative bar associations, like the Detroit Metropolitan Bar and criminal defense attorneys, do realize what's happening to the Constitution under this illegal regime that rules us.
But they didn't go to Washington to protest eavesdropping and much worse things that are happening.
These groups did. Really, Stella.
I know a lot of these people.
And the CCR, what is it? The Committee for Constitutional... Why can't I remember?
Rights.
Yeah, the Committee for Constitutional Rights, CCR. All right. God, somebody more cynical than me.
Than us. Rock on, sister.
I don't think of you as cynical.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Come on, Peter.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I am an optimist, but geez, that only goes so far in this world.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Todd, who is in his truck. Go ahead, Todd. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight?
We're doing good.
I was just curious. I was listening, or I should say watching the news gallery, and they had Warren Buffett on there. And he was running numbers about his income tax, where he pays 18% of his gross and his assistant or secretary was paying 33%.
Right.
And I guess he was in front of the one of the commissions or whatever.
Yeah, and she makes 80 grand, and how much does he make, you know?
Billions.
Yeah, but then he couldn't get any of his friends to come over and run the numbers. I guess if he's wrong, that he'd give 10 million to their favorite charity. And I guess from what I hear, only three stepped up.
Really? Huh. Well, you know, some of these rich people like Bill Gates and his father and who else? There was somebody else I was just saying there. You know, they support the continuation of the inheritance tax, whereas most wealthy people say, well, I don't want to pay all this. You know, I think you're crackling out just a little bit too much.
Maybe
for
speakerphone.
Us,
I'm not sure what that was.
All right, Todd. Well, I think he's in his truck.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. What about Telluride?
Road noise.
So here I am. I'm at the doctor, right? Because I had this hernia surgery about a month ago. Which
I think you like talking about it.
No, I didn't. I haven't talked about it since.
I'm just kidding.
It was so nothing. In fact, I keep thinking, why don't I go back and play handball? Why don't I chop all the wood I have to chop? Why don't I?
Because you can't yet.
Well, I'm not supposed to do it for 6 weeks. But so that's been the only drawback to this operation is that I have to, kind of control myself. So I was in the doctor's office. He looked at me and says, it's doing good. Goodbye.
Okay, I thought you were going to tell us more stories about it.
No. It's like there was this famous thing, President Lyndon Johnson. What did he do? Yeah, he showed reporters his appendix scar.
Really?
It's about in the same spot. Anyway, so I was looking at the magazines, and they had a skiing magazine. And
you were that bored because you cross-country ski.
Yeah, but this is all downhill, which I don't do. Which is tough. I'm never going to do this. It's too dangerous for me.
It's very, I agree.
But here.
Scary.
Ski Telluride. This is a skiing magazine, folks. Ski Telluride, impeach Bush.
What?
Look at that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my gosh. Wow.
The Telluride Town Council cooks up a controversy. A major storm hit Telluride in August after its town council voted to become the first municipality in Colorado to call for the impeachments of President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney.
And I'm surprised that would make it's a pretty mainstream magazine, right?
Yes. And they're getting all this email from, skiers saying they're never coming there again. They're canceling their reservations.
So it's going to become a cool, more hippie place. We should go then.
Well, it turns out this is just like the Dixie Chicks flap. Remember when Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks said that they're... She said she was over in Europe, and
she said she's ashamed that Bush is from the same state that she is.
And so then these country stations were inundated with hundreds and hundreds of emails and
phone
calls.
They burned her CDs.
Yeah, so it turned out that the overwhelming majority of people that did that weren't even country music fans, but were set up by people like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh
on their shows.
Them. And these weak-kneed stations, particularly the Clear Channel stations, just buckled. In the meantime, that year, wasn't it that the Dixie Chicks were the highest-grossing act?
Yeah.
Five or
something. On tour?
On tour.
Yeah.
And they're, so.
And they're doing just fine. And their latest CD, by the way, is really great because it's all about that.
With between one-third and half of Americans supporting impeachment, it's possible that Telluride's town council rebels have actually launched the town's best guerrilla marketing campaign. Telluride has received as many letters of support from impeachment backers. So will other ski towns follow Telluride's lead?
I don't see Aspen doing it anytime soon.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
No.
Oh, yeah. Lots of fur and diamonds.
Yeah, that's one of those towns that the people that are workers there can't afford to live in.
True.
Yeah,
it's true.
Literally. All right, let's go to Eric in Canada. Thanks for making our show international. Eric, where are you calling from in Canada?
I'm in Ontario, and I'm in my truck.
Oh, okay.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Yes, I was listening to your economy there, and we have the same problems here in Canada, more or less, with where our money's being expended, especially when governments go out, they have a bad habit of just kind of throwing the money away. With the tax base that the United States has compared to Canada, with the population-wise, wouldn't it be kind of nice if our governments at one time, instead of, you know, they have all this money to kind of more or less throw away on everybody else, that they gave their own people like a tax break for, let's say, a year?
There you go. I mean, think about this, the amount of money. I mean, even the amount of money that your Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is spending on military expenditures. And this whole idea that he wants to build all these new battleships for the, you know, the above the Arctic, because that's going to be open up. You know, it's either that or a health program, you know, or to strengthen your health program. So which would you rather have? A good.
Well, you see the thing. Okay, on the military end of it. Well, let's see. I can't really argue with what Canada's doing there, because I went through the Trudeau era. I was in the military at that time, and he more or less told us that he was going to try to take us out of NATO, which he couldn't do. So he did the next best thing. He slashed our military down to nothing. So it's kind of nice to see it built up, because there is. Okay, like where Canada is situated, everybody and anybody can cut through in certain places, and we have no control over that. So we kind of need to get somewhat of a military, but
you know
Canada
what, Eric?
Has gotten so used to being protected by the United States.
Well, Eric, you know what? A lot of Canadians don't like to hear this, but Canada does not need an army, doesn't need a military at all, because you're talking about who's going to be coming through there, what the Russians are going to be coming through there. Well, you're right. The United States, any invasion of North America that would, for one thing, it's inconceivable that that Russia or China or somebody like that is going to somehow launch a ground invasion
into Canada. They're pretty focused on the Middle East.
Yeah, who's focused on
Russia?
Oh yeah, right. So it's almost like a vanity thing. I mean, it's somehow that people feel that they're going to be, that Canada would be reduced in stature if they didn't have a military.
More patriotic,
yeah.
On the other side, right?
And it's a total waste of Canadian money. I mean, most armies are, and in fact, all armies are. And if somehow we could get everyone to reduce their armies, we'd be in good shape. But rather, the world economy is increasingly based around armament production, and that winds up in wars every once in a while. Of course, when you have these wars, you destroy all this equipment, so then you got to make more.
Bigger, better, faster, more.
Yeah, so it's part of the racket. It's part of the international racket. And so I'm going to leave it at that. All right, Eric, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I would say take the money and for make the Canadian universal health care system so it can be a little quicker, perhaps, right?
Yeah, or whatever they
need.
That's
the one complaint that I've, the only one I've ever heard.
Yeah, right.
From my Canadian
friends.
Yeah,
so all of this money that Canada is expending on its military could be going into health care or whatever else is needed.
And aren't the people most important?
Boy, you must be some kind of communist.
Here come the emails.
You sound like a communist to me. Here's Mike in Allen Park, and Jolene is going to be playing in Allen Park, right?
Yes.
Yeah, what's
Monterey
the
Music Cafe, December 8th,
we'll be
Saturday
there.
Night. Be there.
Mike, you going to be there?
Yeah, I'm going to be there. And everybody out there, I need to tell you to wake up. It's all part of the master plan of the Illuminati's and George Bush W. and his cronies. And the objective is New World Order. And what people were in shock over 9/11 is going to be nothing compared to what happens in 08. Multiple nuclear attacks in cities and martial law enforced in the United States. There probably won't even be an election in November.
Why do I keep hearing this thing, Peter?
About what?
Do you know this, in the last week, this is the fourth time that I've heard someone say there's not going to be an election in November.
Well, they also said there wasn't going to be an election in 04.
Well, they also said that the millennium, that everything was going to, you know, blow up.
Well, wait a minute, Mike. Tell people quickly what the Illuminati is.
Yes.
There wasn't an election in 02 in 2000, and there wasn't an election.
Well, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, yeah.
We agree.
There was a stolen election.
We agree.
Yeah.
They were both rigged.
They were.
But
are you there? Tell me what the Illuminati is.
Yeah.
The Illuminati's, they want to cleanse the world of the so-called lowlifes, you know, and that which they view as lowlifes.
You mean like Peter and I?
Like you and me.
Like all
right?
Us?
Like the people, you know, we're the pawns in their game of chess that they're playing. And I think it's a pretty sad state of the world, and people just need to stand up. Can you say coup d'etat?
Can you say? I can. My French is...
is
perfect. All right, we got to take a break. Thank you very much. We'll give you a little more on the Illuminati when we come back. This is the Night Call Show. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. Open lines for you if you'd like to give a call.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Another dream goes up in smoke.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Julene Jordan joins me.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
I'm here.
And, man, I'm not working this computer too well because I lost what I was going to read. But anyway, we'll start with this, that at 1 a.m. in exactly 1 hour, I'll be interviewing Derek Jensen. He's the author, As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. That's another cheery little note. Actually, we're going to begin with Craig Covey. He's the mayor-elect of the city of Ferndale. Man, that sounds boring, doesn't it?
No.
But he's the first openly gay mayor, and you could say, well, that's worth about 3 minutes. But this guy is really good.
Yeah, he can do a half-hour interview well.
Yeah.
Unlike me speaking right now.
Yes. 313-298-WRIF is our number.
313-298-9743. How was that?
Nice and slow.
Yeah,
nice and slow. All right, here is Paul in Southgate. Paul, thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Good evening, Peter. How are you?
We're good.
I just wanted to, I guess, review a couple of things you had mentioned about the disadvantages of the weak dollar, but there are a lot of advantages that I don't hear people, talking about in the benefit of the weak dollar. For example, the exports, in the United States are going through the roof, which is one of the things that has kept our economy, increasing like it has because, with the problems that they're having with China products, as we've all heard with the lead and the various other problems with the China products, people know that the United States products are still some of the best produced around the world. And with the strength of the dollars, like the euro, like you were speaking of, our products, being the quality products that they are just a real bargain to everybody overseas. Our trade deficit, last year, the trade deficit from China dropped 5.4%.
Yep.
And our exports have increased, 1.5% just last month and over 1.1% the previous month. And these are all good things to help our economy.
I know, but this manipulation of the money supply and its value is a pretty risky deal. And probably that's why the guys that can control the worth of the money, why they did that. On the other hand, it makes everything that we earn worth less. Remember, the Canadian dollar used to be worth 64 cents, now worth like $1.08.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, we're going to start.
Worth less by compared to what? What is it that when you other the oil prices have increased, but I mean, what is it that you're buying less of? What has become when our dollar becomes worth less is when we're buying products that are imported into the United States. So, for example, all the products from China and Japan that we've complained about importing these cheap products, those products have become slightly more expensive. But when we're buying American-made products purchased by Americans using the American dollar, it's all the same dollar.
American-made products. Okay. I'm going to take a look for those.
Yeah,
thank you,
not
Paul.
One television.
Yeah.
I know that.
Well, I'm going to go get some athletic shoes made in the U.S. Oh. No.
If you go to some socially conscious magazines or catalogs, you can.
I'll tell you, I have 6 items of clothing on, and I don't think one of them was made.
You do?
A T-shirt. What would you call this?
You are. That would be a sweater, yeah.
Sweater, sweatshirt kind of thing.
Yeah.
T-shirt, my underpants.
We don't need to go through the whole thing.
My Levi's, my socks, and my shoes.
And they're all made where?
Elsewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'm probably a little guilty myself.
Right. Well, I don't know, guilty. It used to be a thing like 20 years ago, buy American, right? It's kind of hard to do that.
To find it.
Yeah.
Yeah, or I try to find, we used to have that store, that wonderful store where there was fair trade clothing. My kitchen store.
Yeah.
And
The
Waking Up store. And honestly, if you go online, you can find fair trade products, period. I have fair trade coffee.
Yeah. How about fair trade underwear?
Well,
I think my underwear It was made in the United States.
I'm just going to stop right there.
Okay. All right.
It's best.
The new film, Redacted, this new film by Brian De Palma, a very, very frightening film. It was based on this, I can always say these Arabic words or towns before.
Mahmoudia.
Mahmoudia. Yeah.
That was the one where the 14-year-old Iraqi girl was raped and murdered and burned.
And her family was killed.
Her family was killed, her younger sister, her parents. And, this is all about that. Now, there was a fight for its release, or that damn Bill O'Reilly's trying to call for a boycott. Whatever.
Not only that, he's calling for a boycott of the Dallas Mavericks because the movie's distributor, Mark Cuban, owns the team.
Right. And I like this part. For his part, Mark Cuban has called O'Reilly a moron.
Mark Cuban cannot dance.
He can't dance, but he has a clue.
Yeah, how do we know that?
He's Dancing with the Stars. And you know what? I don't watch it. I don't watch TV, but I did know. I think it's because of who he was that he was on there. So,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it's on the old Yahoo.
So here, there's a number of films about Iraq, which are redacted, rendition. What else are they? The Lords of the Lamb, or the Lamb of the Lords, or something like that. In the Valley of the Fill in the Blank. I count on you for all this popular.
Well, a lot of these movies, if it's about Iraq, unless it's a documentary, I'm not interested.
Well,
I'm not interested in fictional tales of Iraq. It's the reality is bad enough. I don't need to go to a movie and watch it for quote unquote entertainment. I refuse.
They have not been doing well. Even though a number of them apparently are very good films. And I'll tell you, folks, I don't think I'm going to go. I think that the imagery there is so horrific.
This is one I think I want to see, though.
Oh.
Because it's about a real story.
Yeah, but it's about a real story. It graphically depicts an atrocity by American troops. And a lot of this, here is that buffoon, O'Reilly, saying where he has some quote in here. About that it was going to encourage the terrorists or something. Well, dumbass remark.
Yeah.
Oh, incite anti-American hatred throughout the world.
Right.
Well, I think George Bush and Bushko have taken care of that. I mean, the very fact the United States has invaded and occupies Iraq is enough.
Yeah, and I don't understand so many people don't get it, Peter, that it really is anti-American, and it's anti-American government. It's not because I, as a woman, can speak on the air, quite loud and proudly. It's not because I, as a woman, have the right to choose or I'm free and I don't have to wear a burqa. The bottom line is what the United States, what Britain, and what Israel has been doing around the world. This is what has sparked the entire situation. This is what they're pissed off at.
Yeah, I think you're right. Here, Steve writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hello, Peter. It's not a war. It's an illegal occupation.
Thank
all
you.
In caps.
We agree.
Not trying to be a pain, because he's written this to me before, because we talk about the war in Iraq. He said, but I think it's very important.
Well, it is very important. And, sometimes I think what happens is it's just such a part of the way it's spoken about and the way it's presented in the media. And oftentimes we're going directly off of, for example, this redacted story, the redacted Iraq war flick finally released. It's just so ingrained in the media.
Yeah,
in our
I think you're
society.
Right. The fact that Bill O'Reilly is calling for a boycott of Redacted is the best thing that could happen. He knows that, too. Remember, I haven't said this in a long time, but remember sometimes I say, deal them the cruelest blow of all, ignore them?
That's a good one.
Just a little parenthesis. Oh, I know I couldn't. I tried it.
Parenthetical?
Yeah, parenthetical, I can say
parentheses.
Parentheses. That's easy for you to say.
You are a radio professional.
Yeah, Illuminati is a name that referred. We're talking about the Illuminati, or somebody called in before that. Refers to several groups, real and fictitious. It was actually a group, the Bavarian Illuminati, which is an Enlightenment-era secret society found in the late 18th century.
Okay.
However, in modern times, it refers to a purported conspiratorial organization which acts as a shadowy hand behind the throne, allegedly controlling world affairs through present-day governments and corporations, usually as a modern incarnation, or continuation of the Bavarian Illuminati. There isn't.
Okay.
That's not. There are conspiracies. In fact, world capitalism is sort of a conspiracy of men who never meet.
Oh.
And they do meet sometimes. They meet at G8 meetings, those big together. They meet here in the United States at their little gatherings. I can't even remember.
Their secret society. What's that one out in California?
Where they all dance around naked and all that?
Yeah.
I don't want to see Henry Kissinger dancing around naked.
Ew.
Yeah, I don't either. All right. But speaking of conspiracies, here's Jeff in Warren. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Jolene. How you doing?
Hi.
Hey, you're breaking up a little.
California.
Whoa, oh, Jeff.
Wait.
Jeff, you are breaking up big time. So what I want to do is put you on hold and see if we can clear that up with our phone screener, who is either Jeremy.
It's Jeremy, I believe, tonight.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's see. We'll go to Jason. Jason's in Ypsilanti. Hi, Jason. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi. Interesting show tonight.
Thank you.
I think everybody should really be talking more about the economy, and I think it's good you brought it up in probably, I don't know, the most. Some people may say it's too sophisticated, but really people just need to think more about it.
So you're not confused, like the one guy who called said he was so confused he couldn't even think of anything to say.
Well, I certainly don't claim to know everything, but I have studied it quite a bit for many years. And I have to say the last person who called in talking about why dollar devaluation can be a good thing is pretty confused. And they purposely do that to people, and that's what makes this so hard to identify and fix the problems, which is the way they like it. And unfortunately, the guy who called in is probably a conservative, and 100 years ago he would never be allowed to be a conservative because conservatives believed in the gold standard. They would never go along with printing up money. But that's what we're doing, and I just want to list off why it's bad for us to print off a bunch of money and why the... Our interests as working people are not aligned with the elites. They do this for their own reasons, and then they try and convince us that it's good for us, but it's not. Let me
interrupt you just to remind people that I said that the Federal Reserve System has pumped in about $47 billion worth of liquidity, which essentially is just printing up all this money, right? To stabilize the economy.
I mean, to save our asses.
Yeah, that's
right.
Well, they loan it to the Federal Reserve banks. There's 12 Federal Reserve banks around the country, and that they in turn loan it to the large commercial banks like Citibank and Wells Fargo, and the large commercial banks. Who then it all affects how all the markets operate. And basically, what they do when they create all this money is it props up all the corporations and all the other banks and makes sure they can meet their payrolls and make sure they can loan each other money and keep everything running. It doesn't really help the little guy that much, except to just keep everything running. You know, although what it does is hurts us because when you print up money, the last person to get it is the guy on the bottom. It's trickle down.
Sure.
So the last person to spend money is the one who basically gets hurt the most, because as it goes down the system, it causes inflation. And by the time you spend it, all the other prices have adjusted, because when you print more money, you have more money chasing after the same amount of products.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just end up bidding up the price. That's why you're talking about that stamp that cost $800,000.
Right.
That's a sign that they're printing up money and the rich people don't know what to do with it. And they bid each other up, all these stupid little baubles that they have. And that's the money isn't designed to ever get to us. It's to keep all the institutions of power running. Obviously, we don't have the money to go out and buy stuff to keep the bank running or to put in the bank account. We don't have extra money, so they got to get it from somewhere. So they print it, and they make sure their institutions keep running. It doesn't help us. You have to think that way. And there's a lot of other reasons, like why we shouldn't print up money. It makes oil more expensive, which we have to import.
Right.
We, you know, we don't produce enough anymore. What he's talking about is exporting our goods and makes those cheaper. But the thing is, we've so denuded or, ruined our capacity to manufacture and export hard goods anymore that no one will invest or hasn't invested in most of the things that we could export. Let's remember, even the cars that we make, a lot of the parts are made in Canada and Mexico, you know, because they already, Mexico already devalued its currency back in 95, and Canada has a stable currency.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing about investment, we borrow $2 billion a day just to keep our economy running, and we're putting that in jeopardy because people don't want to loan us money when our money keeps losing value. We're borrowing it from abroad.
Well, first off, Jason, let me say I love it when people do my job. You are not saying it in a confusing way. You are saying it in a very clear way. But see, one of the things is this is a case where the debtor has the creditor by the cojones. Because what's China going to do? China will make some noise about not continuing to invest, buying treasury bonds and what have you that keeps us being the United States afloat. But we owe them so much money, they're forced, and they are actually forced to continue to prop up the dollar.
For the time being. But the thing is, you come to a point of mutual assured destruction in this case with currencies,
right?
And there's going to come a point where China simply can't. We're going to devalue so much that they simply can't keep loaning us the money, and that day is going to accelerate as we keep creating more and more of this money. And unfortunately,
more and more debt.
It cannot continue. And nobody knows how long, but we're creating the day, our own doomsday, by doing this.
I agree. All right. Thank you. Thank you for saying that probably better than I could. Appreciate it. Let's go back to Jeff. Jeff, we're going to try again. Jeff, let's try it now. How do you sound here?
Peter, Jolene, can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, that's
much
great.
Much better.
You must have moved or crossed the room or something.
Well, I'm going over the Internet, and I was downloading stuff at the same time. I had to shut it all off.
No, okay. Go ahead. Sound good.
But the club for rich sickos that you were talking about in Northern California is called Bohemian Grove.
Oh, that's
right.
Thank
you.
That's right.
Thank you.
The club that they divvy up the spoils of the world is called the Bilderberger Group.
That's right. And then there's the Club of Rome.
And the last caller was exactly right about how inflation is put about by printing more money. But Peter, one thing that I don't seem to see you understanding, and I don't understand why, when you talk about the Federal Reserve, how those of us who believe before 1913 we were a free country, and after 1913 we're a slave country, you have to understand that in 1913 American money was controlled by Congress. Congress was controlled by the people. We had control of our own money. It was worth something. It was backed up by gold. When they came about with the Federal Reserve program that was conspired at Jekyll Island by J.P. Morgan and the international bankers, not by politicians, created by bankers.
Let me just interrupt here. I mean, I've heard all of that before. I mean, the idea that the United States was a free country in 1913 is absurd. For one thing, there was incredible segregation. Women couldn't vote. There was virtual class war that was getting worse all the time. The gulf between the rich and the poor and the working class that had lived under the most miserable conditions imaginable were present. The country was, at some levels, although it was, even before Europe went to war, was gearing up for war. One of the reasons to do so was to eradicate the huge reform movements that were beginning to take place. And there were these continuing economic troughs, like these panics. I mean, some of them were certainly manipulated by the people you mentioned. Huge depressions of the 1890s. And the capitalists that ran things decided, we've got to have some way to have some regulation of the economy. Now, I'm not supporting the Federal Reserve System. The other thing is, there's not enough gold in the world to back the extent of the world economy. You've got to have it just on smoke and mirrors.
You're jumping the gun there. What the Federal Reserve System did is not – it did not stabilize the situation. What it did is it created a system of debt. We went from having value to our money and controlling our money to being 100% in debt to the bankers, a private for-profit corporation.
If you mean we the people, we never had control over this economic system or the government ever. It's always been didn't you use that phrase the other day? The worms, the white old rich men. I mean, that's who always controlled things right from the beginning. And it's been a matter of the common people, the vast majority of us, trying to eke out, either as individuals, a living without, getting the hammer coming down on us too hard, or collectively getting together and trying to alter circumstances so, children don't work in factories and we don't work 13 hours a day and conditions are totally unsafe. So we never had control of our money or the economy. They had and have control of the economy.
That's not true. The first two banks of the United States were controlled secretly by the Bank of England and are essentially the same thing we have with the Federal Reserve System now. But Andrew Jackson in the 1830s killed the bank. It's on his headstone in Washington that he killed the bank. Is what he did is he figured out that who controls the money controls government. And he killed the bank, and it took him over 70 years to regain control. The Constitution says that the government, Congress, controls the value of money and prints money.
Well, what would be the – say, all right, let's get rid of the Federal Reserve System tomorrow. What benefits would accrue, or do you think things are too screwed up by now to –
We wouldn't be paying billions of dollars in interest every single day just to use their money that has our name on it.
Why wouldn't we? I mean, that we are operating, it's like, credit card debts. We as a country, I don't want to say we, the country is operating beyond its income, right?
Exactly. It's a credit card debt. Why on earth are we using our economy system like a credit card when we can print our own money and pay nobody interest?
I'm not sure.
If Congress prints its own money, and like it did before the Federal Reserve, that's interest-free money. Why are we paying the Federal Reserve interest on using their money?
Well, it's not the Federal Reserve isn't making a fortune off of this. I mean, who's making the fortune? The interest are the foreign banks that are financing the United States right now.
Why can't the United States finance itself? Why do we have to borrow 100% of our money?
Well, because
we're spending it all in the Middle East.
Yeah, and because Bush put into effect all these tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, there should be, what were they talking about? Getting rid of expanding the payroll tax of the Social Security tax so it would be on all income, which would mean that, Hillary Clinton said that would be $1 trillion tax increase. I'd say that's good because all of a sudden all the people that are making hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars and tens of millions of dollars would have to start paying their fair share of things. In fact, what we could do would be to start eliminating taxes on the middle class and the working class and have the rich people pay it. I mean, and then they would still be rich. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. We will be right back. 313-298-WRIF. Open lines for you, and that's numerically
313-298-9743.
Thank you, Jillian, and we will be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to the final segment of this hour. 1 a.m., remember, a couple of very interesting interviews, beginning with the mayor-elect of the city of Ferndale. Man, that sounds so boring. But Craig Covey, this was a great interview. I love doing it. Craig is an extraordinarily interesting guy. He's the first openly gay mayor of in Michigan. And he didn't get it at first, and you can hear this in the interview when I was saying that it was the emphasis was on openly. Because there's an, I mean, I know at least one other gay mayor who
not so open?
Not so open.
Right.
At all.
Did you make sure to ask him if it's okay if you talk about him?
Oh, I'm not saying who it is.
Okay.
I'm not gonna.
Oh, wait, you don't know him. That's right.
No,
personally.
I do know him.
I was trying to save you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. He denied it.
All right.
Yeah. We were talking about the economy, and I was saying about an hour or more, an hour and a half ago, to how depressing it was, but I had even more depressing stuff. And I guess, fortunately, we don't even, fortunately for our spirits, we don't have time to talk about it. The casualties in Iraq, they think now, when you start factoring in the suicides that CBS did this special report on, that there may have been 15,000 or more U.S. deaths as a result of the Iraq war, that more men and women, particularly men, of course, have died as a result of suicide.
Yeah.
That they think that there's as many as 120 suicide every week.
Every week?
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
CBS discovered that in 2005 alone,
there
were at least 6,256 among those who served in the armed forces. That's 120 each and every week in just 1 year.
Okay. And people say they had good experiences.
Yeah.
Right on.
There's,
okay.
Yeah. And there's other things, too, like Russia's decided to suspend compliance with the arms treaty that has kind of kept everything at a,
at bay?
At bay, but now, because Bush wants to put these, Bush is violating the anti-ballistic missile treaty and is going to put these missile defense systems in Central Europe. And, of course, that all of that pales beneath the story about the environment, which is so depressing that I don't even know. In the Independent, which is an English newspaper, it says, a world dying. That's ours, folks. But can we unite to save it? Pollution in the seas is now speeding global warming. They say that humanity is rapidly turning the seas acid through the same pollution that causes global warming. I can't deal with it.
Well, yeah.
I can't deal with it.
SeaShepherd.org.
Yeah, for all of that. Oh, yeah. Also, that the Japanese are going to start killing humpback whales.
Big time want. They're out there to get them.
SeaShepherd.org, indeed. All right, here's Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim, are you going to cheer us up? Tim? Tim. Let me see. I can't see these. Yeah. Hi, you're on the air. Oh, this is the one of those things where you gotta.
I was just waiting.
You gotta press
patiently
his phone as well. Oh, there you go, Tim. You're on the air. Are you gonna cheer us up?
I don't think so. I mean, actually, the acidification of the seas has been on for some time, and it actually is turning the seas the acidification of soda pop.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, no creature can survive this stuff. It's really pathetic. And what gets me about these right wingers is they look for these hidden conspiracies when it's all out in the open.
Yeah.
I mean, if the Fed closed down tomorrow, we'd still have the same problems, the same debts to China, etc. The dollar would be worthless. You could back it up by all the gold in the galaxy, and it wouldn't get any better.
Well, there is not enough gold to back the modern economy. I mean, in fact, it's all just based on sort of faith, if you think about that. It's all cyber wealth. It's not like somebody who's worth, like Senor Slim. I can't remember his first name, the richest man in the world now from Mexico because our dollar is devaluated and Gates is no longer the richest. That it's not like he's got, Scrooge McDuck. It's not like he's got some big cave where he's got all his money. It's all just cyber wealth, right?
Now, he made his money on what, like a future or something?
No, he did a lot of telecommunications. He did everything. He owns half of Mexico. You know.
Okay, so as I see it, I mean it's, we live in a kind of a pyramidal system. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
And until we have some fundamental changes, both here and worldwide, I mean, we're not going to get out of these traps because it's actually lawful for a corporation to make a profit. In fact, they couldn't do otherwise. So, you know, if you put profit first, you're going to, by definition, exploit people. You're going to exploit the land. You're going to exploit all the resources. And if people don't really understand that, we're going to keep playing the same game until we're going to have to move to another planet just to survive, because our planet is almost environmentally destroyed.
Yeah. You know, now you can go into Lake Erie around Toronto. You can take an old-fashioned photograph, and you can develop film. You can develop it. You go at night, and you can, you know, when you print a photograph, take like an 8x10 sheet of paper, and, you know, what you do, you expose the negative, right? And then you can take that, and you can put that in Lake Erie outside of Toronto, and in the morning, your picture will develop.
No.
Well, that's true.
What else was I going to say regarding, I think I said something about the lakes or something, that I think there's like BP. I mean, just recently, they poured in all this crap, and I think it was Lake Michigan or something. It just poured tons and tons of it, and they got fettered for it, so what, they went ahead and poured it anyway.
Yeah, or maybe it is Lake Michigan. Yeah, there's something. Well, E. E. Cummings, American poet, wrote from like the 20s through the 50s or something. He had some line that was something like, I don't want to frighten you, but they mean to kill us all.
Oh, you haven't said that one for a while.
I know. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Oh, and here's another call. Here's Jeremy on the road. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
We're doing good.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm like, I was telling your screener, I said, I'm not a real political person, but I got like a simple question for you. With the amount of this money that it's costing to go to war over in Iraq,
yeah,
how much more is the United States going to take before we say that it's pretty much our country and be able to fluctuate the oil cost and the actual cost of what's going on over there?
Well, I think that's certainly part of it. I mean, the idea was that these real brainy neocons said that the Iraqi oil would pay, that what did they say was something like $40 billion or $60 billion, and that would end it all. And we'd wind up with forward bases there and control of the oil and everything like that. Well, sure hasn't wound up like that. But I agree. You know, we should have the amount of money that's spent there by, you know, own it. Yeah, we could. What we're talking about now, what, $3.5 trillion? Yeah, that buys a lot, doesn't it? Unfortunately, it's all just based on misery and
lies.
And lies. All right. Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for joining us. Here's Eric. Eric's in Woodhaven. Hi, Eric. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Oh.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to call in on a couple of your callers tonight. You've had a lot of good ones. The one guy that was talking about the Illuminati and how the economy runs, or how they run our government, it's really the economy. And I mean, it's too big and too confusing, like your first caller, for anyone to even manage it. It's just, I'm lost for words here.
Well,
it's tough to grasp. I mean, I tune out. It's tough at times. I mean, I really, maybe I need to read the article that you were telling me about in the Left Business Observer, Peter.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it is tough. And one of the things that I said that if you really think about it, the fundamentals of life, and I don't mean to speak for you, but I think there is a human condition which wants certain things, wants security, wants love, wants some assuredness that we're not all going to get eradicated by some insane army or terrorist or some human-created weather disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And an economy that, as I said earlier, is simple. That what's needed is to produce things and to consume things and to do it in a manner that's environmentally non-destructive. So why are things so crazy? Because, well, I mean, geez, 150 years ago or more, Ralph Waldo Emerson said that things are in the saddle and ride man, and things certainly take precedence over, as they called it at that time, man, human beings. And why is that? There's not one of us, there's not a single one of us, whether you're poor or rich or middle class or working class, that thinks that things ought to dominate human beings. So why do they? So maybe it is. I mean, certainly we have these greedy people, and we haven't had them all throughout history, that want to profit at the expense of others. But ultimately, who does it work for? Well, I mean, what? It's all quite mad. And we could really come to a bad end unless we start making some efforts to change it all. And that's what's so hard. That's what I was saying earlier. Okay, I'm going to change things, so tomorrow I'm going to, yeah. So we better figure it out quick. All right, thank you, Eric. Appreciate your comments. Yeah, what do we do tomorrow? Well, there are certain things we can say. Okay, we'll meet our friends down at Nine Mile Road in Woodward that are protesting the Iraq War, and that's a good thing.
Every Monday.
Yeah, and there'll be anywhere from the usual 15 to 50 people there, which is cool. But, you know, things would begin to change if there were 5,000 people there tomorrow.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? But we got to work, and we got to pick up the kids, and I don't know.
Well, we don't have any kids.
Yeah, right. We're not going to work tomorrow.
Yes.
So we should go there.
Well, I think we better.
Yeah. Speaking of Ferndale, here is Joe in Ferndale. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hey, Joe. Turn your radio off.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. How you doing there?
I'm doing good. How about you?
All right.
Yeah.
I was calling to mention the whole rising of taxes, you know, of Granholm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. We're from Port Huron up here, and it's kind of a bad area, you know. No money, no jobs.
Well, I think that's in Michigan in general, eh?
Yeah, just taxes in general.
Yeah, well, I agree. I don't think there should be taxes at all, like sales taxes. I don't certainly see. She's required. Granholm is the governor. She's required by the Michigan Constitution to have a balanced budget. So they got to get money from somewhere. And part one of the ideas was just to cut social programs for people, so the poor would be even more screwed. So instead, they thought they would share the misery a little more and tax people that are working in the middle class. Well, the working people and middle class people are already suffering enough. So what they should really do is increase the business tax. Well, then all the businesses would say, okay, we're out of here. We're going to Mexico. We're going to China. So they've got us blackmailed into the point where we can't make them pay anymore. How about all the wealthy people? I don't know why. Why don't we just tax the rich? They're making so much damn money and making more and more. You know, they don't even know what to do with their money, like the one caller said. So they're buying $800,000 stamps for their little stamp collection. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Okay, and let's see. Here is Al. Al is in Inkster. Al has some good news for us, I think.
Hey, Pete. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
How are you guys tonight?
We're great.
Well, I'm a little bit depressed.
Yeah.
Now, so am I, and I was even more depressed after I picked up the Daily Fish wrapper and found out there was 121-page supplement listing tax foreclosures.
Yeah, that's right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
121 pages. As near as I could guess, it's about 15,000 different properties that are being foreclosed just for taxes.
This might be just in Wayne County, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not Oakland County or any of the other counties around Detroit. Yeah. So,
wow. I thought you said he had good news for us.
Yeah, I was kidding. Yeah.
That was sarcasm.
Okay. I get it now.
Yeah.
There is good news. My dog was happy.
Oh, well,
why is your dog happy? Dogs are pretty easy to make happy.
Yeah, feed them and pet them, and they're pretty much good to go, you know?
And people make dogs so unhappy so often.
Yeah, they do.
They do. Which,
but we digress.
Yeah, are we digressing?
And that's the only good news you're getting is my dog was happy.
Okay.
My dog's
we'll
happy,
take
too.
It. My dogs are happy.
All right, Al. Thank you. We could laugh it up going, ho, ho, ho.
Oh, but not in Australia.
Not in Australia, no. Tell us about that one. You got that handy?
I don't have it handy. I could in a second, but it's basically a story about their saying you shouldn't say ho, 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 the Santa Claus is there.
Yeah.
Because it's offensive to women.
Right.
Okay. You know what, Peter? I'm a feminist.
Yeah.
Okay. You know that. I'm pretty hardcore. But I don't care if they say ho, ho, ho. Instead, they have to say ha, ha, ha.
That's ridiculous.
It really is ridiculous.
I saw some movie.
Leave Santa alone, someone said.
Yeah. I saw this These two kids were fighting, and this teacher broke it up. I think they were two African-American kids in this movie. And he said, "Why are you fighting?" And he said, "He called my mama a hoe." And he says, "Well, just because he called her a garden implement is no reason to start a fight."
Oh, my.
That's ridiculous.
That is. Halloween's over.
Yeah, it is. Ho, ho, ho. All right.
So not in Australia. It's ha, ha, ha.
Here's Lars. Lars is from Madison Heights. Lars, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Angelina. I just wanted to talk about what my theory on why so many of the homeless are veterans.
Yeah, why?
Well, because aside from the mental problems, a lot of it, I think, has to do with the jobs available to people with military experience. Because it's like if you're an enlisted grunt, when you get out of the military, your three basic jobs options are janitor, security guard, or mercenary.
Okay.
Like that's if you're hoping to make more than, you know, $8 an hour. You can either spend it scrubbing other people's stuff or, you know, just wearing uncomfortable shoes, walking around the mall, or making $200,000 a year, you know, doing extremely dangerous work in Iraq. But those represent the things that, you know, people in the military hate most about the military. So it's like, and plus, this is just something I've noticed about myself, I'm more or less indifferent to the temperature. It's like, if I had to choose between, you know, maybe working 12 hours a day at like two part-time, you know, $6.50 jobs and, you know, spending every cent I make on rent and ramen noodles, you know, going from that to homeless wouldn't really be that much of a stretch.
Really?
Homelessness would actually be easier.
Wow. Yeah. Well, one of the things they found out, too, is that guardsmen have not been always getting their jobs back when they came back from
certain, oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I mean, it's just, you know, there's all this lip service about support our troops, and when it comes down to it, it ain't the deal. That's really unfortunate. All right, Lars, thank you very much. Appreciate your calls. Yeah, this came about, I don't think this is real news, but you know how with cell phones, they're just everywhere. I have a friend of mine was driving to Florida, and he was talking to me as he was driving. And his companion I could hear her next to him talking on her cell phone.
Yeah, I've been there, done that. Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got this thing now. It's called the cell phone jammer.
Oh, I've heard about this.
Yeah.
Gadget, not too sure how I feel about it.
A gadget that renders nearby mobile devices impotent.
Well, a lot of shop owners are using it, especially in bigger cities where if people are on the phone and they're knowing it, they'll just press this. And then I know that some people can buy it on their own. They're using it in airplanes.
Yeah. Well, you're not supposed to be on.
Well, before you take off, you know.
Says,
remember, what was her name? Hot Lips Houlihan?
Yeah.
I remember I saw her talking on a cell phone one time on an airplane.
From MASH.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think she was it was a fake call. She didn't want anyone to talk to her.
The buyers include owners of cafes and hair salons, hotel owners, public speakers, theater operators, bus drivers, and increasingly commuters on public transportation. So, you know, this is illegal to do.
To be on the phone?
No, using jammers.
Well, yeah.
In the United States, because the radio frequencies that are used by the cell phone carriers are protected, just like the ones used by radio and television.
Oh, my.
But so you got to go overseas. And they actually gave a website for this. But
maybe don't.
This appeared in the New York Times. And then these irate people called in and said, wait a minute, I've got my kid with a cell phone.
True.
Yeah, but, I mean, gee, didn't we used to have...
these little fifth graders have cell phones, and my niece and nephew, they have cell phones.
Oh, my God.
I know.
I don't have a cell phone.
Well, I know.
All right.
You're a purist.
All right. Well, no, I just don't want one more thing.
If it makes you feel any better, it's, you know, this is my only phone. This is my entire lifeline.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
A lot of people. But, of course, never mind. Let's talk to Jeff in Rochester
Okay.
Hill. Jeff, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, what would it take to get our youth in America to vote?
What is the rate? I mean, what does it take to get Americans to vote?
The youth is what I'm kind of concerned about because I'm 47, and anyone younger than me, they've kind of given up on the whole bureaucracy and everything. We wouldn't have this problem of exporting jobs to China, and we wouldn't have these problems of no tariffs of Chinese imports. If we would just get the American youth to vote, what would it take to get the American youth if not the American public, to vote. We wouldn't have this problem.
Well, maybe some sense that the politicians represented integrity. And it's worse, I think, among liberals because, these conservatives, they're willing to vote and explain away the worst activities of corruption and lying and lack of integrity and hypocrisy and all that. And they'll still just vote for their favorite right winger. Whereas I think people like me and Jalene, I mean, the idea that we're going to be asked to vote for Hillary Clinton, that's a tough one.
That is a tough one. I think also...
Why not Ron Paul? He's more libertarian, even though he's coming on as a Republican.
Not,
I don't mean to choose.
Not going there. Sorry. You know, but I think another thing is that what Hollywood has done a good job of, you know, here we go once again. I mean, remember when Sean P. Diddy or whatever his name is these days, he had that big vote campaign. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of...
Vote or die.
Vote or die. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of organizations that really are. And I'll tell you, after the last, 7 years now, right?
Yeah.
After the last 7 years, I think we're going to see a whole heck of a lot more of the youth paying attention. I think it's gotten to the point where more kids are actually paying attention.
Rock the boat.
We have to get the youth to vote because there's a lot of youth that is just turning off to what is actually going on.
That's right.
On. They don't
They care about Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan and all those little,
Well, it's, people turn off to things when they don't appear to have value to them.
To their own personal,
right.
Oh, my God, I got to get my nails done. You know, I mean, some of these young kids just do not care at all. And I think their parents don't care
either. But I think they retreat into that because the real world of politics looks so compromised and so...
complicated and frightening, maybe.
I think more that it's compromised and corrupt.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think they know that?
There's
if they have parents who are smart enough to tell them that, maybe.
All right, thank you very much. Maybe we can get time.
There was that one young woman that we saw. I don't know if she spoke before when we spoke at the conference last weekend.
Yeah, but Port Huron.
Yeah, and she was young. She looked like perhaps she was early high school years, she was just so involved in the movement. And when we go to marches, we see all of these young kids.
Yeah.
So they're out there, and they're out there in force.
Oh, you know what I forgot? Oh, man, it's so late in the game, too. I was really, let me tell you what. First of all, I was impressed by the good news. There is a movement called Iraq Moratorium. And you go to iraqmoratorium.org. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And the idea is to hold an anti-war demonstration in cities all across the United States on the third Friday of every month. Hope we don't have to do it for a lot more months. But... their photograph, which I stole and put on my calendar page, is from Suwanee, Tennessee, a city of about 2,500, where there's, I don't know, have you seen that photo?
Saw it.
Yeah, well, there's probably, 50 or 60 people in it? In this small town. So we had a demonstration just on Friday here in Detroit, and there's about 50 people there. Come on, Detroit, we can do better than that.
We can.
A lot of the people that put this together were kind of new to these demonstrations, and they were disappointed at the turnout. And I was disappointed that very few people from the mainstream anti-war groups showed up. It was kind of like, oh, that's not, their thing.
Was it? Maybe they didn't know about it.
Yeah, they knew about it.
Okay.
I sent them information.
Shame, shame, shame. Are you shaming them, Peter?
I am. They should be ashamed of themselves. I mean, there's good reasons. I mean, you didn't come for very good reasons.
I had to be on the air at midnight. Yeah.
Right. I know. All right. Here is Steve in Detroit. Steve, it's Peter and Jalene. How are you? Hey, Steve. Am I doing this right? Yeah, I am. Steve, are you there?
Hi.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah, I got some good news for you.
What's
Please.
It?
Okay, that FBI report you were talking about way back at the beginning of the show.
That Detroit's the most dangerous city, yeah.
Well, I don't know how I can say this delicately. I heard you on another station. Well, there's a program that comes on before, and it's basically about, how the press doesn't say things right and
you know,
between the lines and stuff.
Counterspin.
Well, anyhow, on that program, the guy from St. Louis called in. $8 money. And, basically, he's pointed out that on the first page of every FBI report, there's a disclaimer saying that it really doesn't amount to that much, and that cities are like a dynamic
place, and that all depends on what regions and stuff. The report makes it sound like the whole city's that way, and it's not. And it doesn't take into account other factors like traffic accidents and things, and basically amounts to all boils down to behavior. I mean, you can go to the safest city in the country, and if you go in a bar and say you hate George Bush, you might get hurt. So
not anymore. There's no bar in the. I don't think there's any bar in the country where you could do that. But yeah, these statistics.
No, there's a few country clubs. I think.
Really.
You could get clocked out pretty hard.
What we're talking about with Steve is that Detroit has, according to these this study, has pushed past St. Louis to become the nation's most dangerous city. On the other hand, there are people like, for instance, the study drew harsh criticism even before it came out. The American Society of Criminology launched a preemptive strike on Friday, issuing a statement attacking it as an irresponsible misuse of crime data. The 14th annual City Crime Rankings, Crime in Metropolitan America, was published by a unit of the Congressional Quarterly, and it's based on the FBI's September 24th Crime Statistics Report. And it takes into account all these different crimes, homicide, rape, robbery, and what have you. And they weigh it in different ways. And some of the people say that the rankings do groundless harm to any community. President of the American Society of Criminology. They also work against the key goal of our society, which is a better understanding of crime-related issues by both scientists and the public. So I don't know. Is Detroit the most crime-ridden city in America or dangerous? I don't know. I mean, how do you even measure that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the report says dangerous. It doesn't say crime-ridden. It says dangerous.
Dangerous, right. Oh, yeah.
Crime-ridden, I think that would go to Washington, D.C.
There you go. Yeah, you're right. Homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and auto theft.
Right.
So,
Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C., right.
There you go.
But anyhow, I thought that was a little bit good news, and I'm glad you understand that those reports are really not what they appear to be.
Well, on the other hand, it's not like there's absolutely no problems. And what I said at the beginning of the show a couple hours ago was that when you have a city that is so impoverished and getting worse and things that occur that are no result of the people themselves there, that they begin to slide into a situation where these things become greater and greater problems. I mean, I've lived in very, very poor areas, and 95% of the people that live there are good neighbors and good people and what have you. But you have 5% of the people that are involved in crime, it's hell to live there. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller. Well, let's get on with the show. We're going to do our interviews. Jalene just looked at me. Wait a minute. I thought we were ending. Yeah, we are definitely ending the call-in program section. But a couple of interviews following, and I think you'll find those interesting. Thanks for being with us. Jalene Jordan, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, everyone.
And thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Al.
All right, and we'll talk again next week.
This is WRIM.com.
Chicago. I'm going to Chicago.
City is sending you to celebrate New Year's Eve in the biggest party town in the country.
Wow, that's huge.
101 WRAM wants to send you to the biggest, fattest New Year's Eve party ever in Viva Las Vegas. And if that's not enough, you'll see Van Halen live in Sin City.
This could be a really great thing for you.
Keep your radio locked on 101 The Rare for your chance to win a custom WRAF Drew and Mike Booker set. Make sure you use that to sharpen your Texas Hold'em skills, because you and a guest might be jetting off to Sin City. Las Vegas, baby.
Let's get to it.
3 days and four nights of all-out partying, along with tickets for Van Halen live in Vegas. It's a New Year's celebration in the City of Sin.
This thing is wicked.
Hey, come on. Who else is going to send you where the party is? Like your New Year's Eve destination station. 101 WRIF. Every day. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. And from time to time, we need to check on some of the big issues of our era. And sometimes these big issues, they'll kind of diminish in the eyes of those of us who aren't directly affected by the issue, or at least sometimes we think we're not directly affected. Someone who has always been one of the most able spokesmen in our area about the AIDS epidemic is Craig Covey. He's the original founder and CEO of the Midwest AIDS Prevention Project, that's MAP. It was created in 1988 to address the early HIV/AIDS epidemic in Michigan, and they do so with education and prevention program. Craig Covey was elected to the Ferndale City Council in 1999, and in the most recent election was just elected mayor of the city of Ferndale. Craig Covey, we reach him in New Orleans. Should I call you Mr. Mayor, or can I still call you just Craig?
Craig would be great.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Craig Covey back to the Peter Werby Show. Now, besides just congratulating you, this election has a special meaning because, Craig Covey, you are the first openly gay mayor elected in the state of Michigan. So congratulations on that as well.
Thank you kindly. It's very, very cool.
But I think that the real, and we won't even go there, but I think the real emphasis is on openly gay, right?
Yeah, I mean, I came out when I was 17, which was a long, long time ago, and I think, you know, once this has happened, it's really no longer a story. You know, next year we might have the first woman president, we might have the first black president, who knows what will happen next year, but I think it's good to make a statement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was actually, my statement was on openly gay, that
sure.
That there probably are other gay mayors, but for whatever reasons they, whatever. But and I think you're right, and it was, I think it was Laura Berman wrote in the Detroit News that why are we still dealing with first? Well, knocking him back is good, and then we can get on to the issues. Do you, was you being a gay person and a gay activist an issue in Ferndale? I got the feeling most people voted for you because you were the best man for the job.
Well, you know, in a city, what they want is safe streets. They want the garbage to be picked up. They want the sidewalks, you know, to be in good order and the streets to be clean. So that's really what a city election is all about. In Ferndale, we long ago have sort of dealt with the issues of diversity. We understand and accept and embrace diversity. We know that there is a lot of talent out there, and we want everybody to have a place at the table. So at least in Ferndale, and I think in probably a lot of other areas of Michigan, this is going to be a non-issue from here on out.
All right, let's make it a non-issue in terms of the politics for the rest of
sure.
this discussion. And but let's go to the work you've done for almost 20 years with the Midwest AIDS Prevention Project, MAP. Unfortunately, I think that AIDS is not playing a public role, in particularly in consciousness, as it did. Would you agree with that? It's kind of off the radar in many ways.
Well, for a lot of folks, you know, with the way our media, not necessarily your station, but, you know, media in American media in general, sort of goes from one exciting issue to another. Nobody thought, certainly me, believed that I would be doing this work for 19 years, going on 20 years. When HIV/AIDS first appeared in the early 80s, you know, people didn't know what it was. We didn't even understand back then that new diseases could sort of appear. Now we know that there are, you know, viruses and microbes out there that change and evolve. But 19 years later, we are still doing the good work that we do. It's as serious or more serious than ever. More than 40 million people worldwide infected with HIV/AIDS. They say up to 100 million people by the year 2010. So while it may not be on everyone's radar, and, you know, people don't need to think about something 24 hours a day, but I think people know that it's still serious. It's a health issue. It's manageable, but it's still dangerous, and so we're going to keep doing the work until the thing is over with.
Well, it has for so long been associated with the gay community, but that has changed significantly since you began your activist work, correct?
Yes, and, you know, each country, even different regions of countries, the epidemic can look a little bit different. In the United States, still about half of all the HIV infections and half of all the AIDS cases are still among what we call men who have sex with men. Worldwide, though, that changed a long time ago and indeed has been a disease of the general population. More than 90% of the world's AIDS cases are among heterosexual or straight people. So, you know, it can affect anybody.
Let's look at the United States, and perhaps even more significantly for us, and where we're primarily broadcasting to, our region here, southeastern Michigan and Michigan itself. A lot of HIV infection and AIDS has to do with poverty, and some in this state as well. But much of it is, particularly among gay men, is educated, very frequently middle-class men. Why, with all the education, why has that remained a problem in that community?
Well, that's always the $80,000 question, but more and more the disease is affecting, to some extent, minorities. The rate of infection among African-American men and women is much higher than among white men and women. But what we're looking at is behavior, and when you talk about human behavior or look at behavior, that's a pretty intractable situation. It's hard for people, even with the knowledge, and you can look at issues like wearing your seatbelt or eating healthy and, you know, not putting on weight or not smoking. We make progress, but the progress is made in baby steps. People still smoke cigarettes, even though they know that it's very dangerous. People still don't don't get enough exercise, even though they know they should. Not everybody wears a seatbelt when they drive their car, and yet we know that that's, you know, extremely important for your health and for your safety. So part of the job is looking at people's behavior, getting them to think about it, and getting them to take steps to reduce their risk, and that's what HIV education is all about.
Yeah, by the way, you can go to the MAP website, which is AIDSprevention.org. Plenty of information there. Midwest AIDS Prevention Project, MAP, what sort of education are you focusing on? I see in so much of the literature I have here from your group, it's aimed at young people.
Sure. And again, funding is changes in different target audiences, but we have always wanted to focus as much as we can on young people and young adults, because that's where you can affect behavior. You know, it's they're saying it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. When you can reach people that are in schools or younger, you can, I think, have a better impact. Information is what's important. If people have the facts, then they can make decisions that hopefully would be in their own interest. And when you talk about sexuality, of course, again, that's what makes some people nervous. Some people aren't able to talk honestly about sexual behavior, activity. You know, we want our kids to be smart, but we don't always have the tools or the ability to talk to them honestly. And that's what people crave. They crave honest information, and that's what MAP tries to do. We do workshops, programs. We have websites, because a lot of young people get their information. Well, a lot of us now use websites to get information. But really talking to people, listening to them, letting them tell their story, finding out what issues are important to them is helpful.
Yeah, youthaids.com is another good resource, a website as well. My guest is Craig Covey. He's mayor-elect of the city of Ferndale and also the original founder and CEO of the Midwest AIDS Prevention Project, MAP. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show. What is, do you have any idea of the success rate? And I think of how just what a disastrous failure the DARE program is, the thing, you know, to keep kids off drugs. In some ways, in some places they've actually found it's had the opposite effect. That is the DARE program, that it informs kids about drugs they may have never heard of.
Sure.
But there's a tendency of kids, when they're lectured by us adults about smoking or drug use or sexual behavior, they go,
Right.
Yeah. What, any idea of, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to compare you your efforts to such a dismal failure and waste of taxpayer dollars as the DARE program. I'll probably catch some hell for that, but go ahead.
Well, we never lecture folks. What we really do is we are very honest. We give them the information, but we want to talk to people about, you know, what are the issues that affect your behavior. For example, sexuality. We cannot deny that human beings are sexual beings. That to simply say no, the old Nancy Reagan statement in the 80s was just say no. Say no to drugs. Say no to sex. Say no. Doesn't always work. It works for some people. But we have to acknowledge that people are going to be intimate, and even if you can postpone sexuality or sexual behavior, let's say you're 17, 18 years old, you can postpone that, but I don't think we do anybody a service by just telling them not to do this or that, but not giving them the information, the tools. There's a lot of ways to reduce your risk. We've been successful in the sense that while there are still people that are infected with HIV/AIDS, we've had some success at keeping the numbers from going as high as they were at the beginning of the epidemic. Uganda, which is a country in Central Africa, had a huge, very high rate of HIV/AIDS in the 80s and the 90s. The government really paid attention, set up some good programs, went into the countryside, did programming, talked to people, provided condoms, and they brought the rate of infection way down. So it can happen even in a third world country.
Are condoms still, in fact, and I wanted to talk about both the World AIDS Day that's going to be December 1st,
sure,
and the Precious Lives, Precious Metals gala celebration that's going on here in the Detroit area. And in fact, let me just say, I've been thinking about this through in the back of my mind ever since we started talking, Craig Covey, when you said there was 100 million people infected with HIV/AIDS throughout the world. I'm thinking, I don't know why I just didn't fall off my chair and just lay on the floor crying with compassion. I mean, we have to, I guess, sort of inure ourselves to the, those kind of catastrophic figures, or we'd be in tears every moment.
Exactly. I mean, you have to look at it as taking action. I mean, there is always going to be issues around the world, and we can't solve all of the world's problems. There is poverty there, and there are other diseases that go on. World AIDS Day, which is always December 1st of each year, is a very effective way to bring the world's attention back to this issue. Again, with the media, there's always a lot competing for our, attention. And I think just taking action in this, in the sense of with World AIDS Day, literally thousands of events all across the world. You can go to any country in Africa or Asia or Australia, and in the U.S. there's literally thousands of programs. I think we have three different programs that day. You take advantage of any media attention that you can get. We have a spaghetti dinner in Ferndale that raises a little bit of money for our program called WAGS, which helps people with HIV/AIDS keep their pets. We know that, you know, having a dog or a cat or a pet is actually beneficial to your health. And so we created this program that enables us to assist with veterinarian bills and pet food costs so that someone who is ill can keep their dog or their cat. There's another service at some other churches in town. The Tappers event is really neat. Tappers is it's a high-end jeweler in West Bloomfield, and they have been supportive of charitable events for years. And because they're having their 30th anniversary in business, they selected the World AIDS Day to hold a very nice event. But even now, they've got a program where you go in and you make a donation to MAP or Youth AIDS, and you automatically get a certificate back that you can, you know, use if you make a purchase. But we have to use every avenue that we can, corporate support, government support, and going into the schools, really anywhere we can go to talk to people, because, again, I think it's just very serious and very important that people have the knowledge they can then use to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. The event, again, is called Precious Lives, Precious Metals, a gala celebration. It will be at Tappers, is it? No.
It is. They're at the Orchard Mall.
Yeah, on Orchard Lake Road in West Bloomfield. You go to Tappers.com. Tappers.com. That will give you all the information. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Mayor-elect of Ferndale, Craig Covey. I started to ask a question in my typical way, moved away from it, and that was about condoms. And you said that in Uganda there was actually success. There's been, to some extent, sort of anti-condom propaganda over the last few years, mostly generated by right-wing sources saying that these will not protect you, that you can still get any number of sexually transmitted diseases. Are condoms your best bet?
They are very effective. They're not your only tool in the tool belt, as they say, but if I have a frustration about the work I've done in 19 years, it is that we still have to fight some of the political baggage, which is just silly that a disease would be politicized. But, you know, even health care in this country has become a political issue. That is too bad. For a variety of reasons, and partly because the disease affected the gay community, there were folks who didn't want to deal with it, didn't want to discuss it, didn't want to have it talked about in the schools, and to this day don't always want to fund the programs. Since the current person has been in the presidency, AIDS funding has gotten harder to come by, and they attach strings for the kinds of programs that we know are effective. We sometimes have our hands tied behind our backs because we're, you know, not allowed to talk about this, or we can't push that. Again, it's just what we need to do is talk honestly about human behavior, but some people don't like to talk about sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, it often has a sort of a liberal and conservative, as almost everything does, liberal and conservative aspect to it. Although I'm really pleased to see that Oakland County Executive Al Brooks Patterson, a conservative, is one of the honorary chairpersons for the gala that's taking place on World AIDS Day,
sure,
December 1st, along with Governor Granholm and State Senator Gilda Jacobs. So,
well, I have to take a little bit of that risk. He's great, by the way, and one of the things that I've always tried to do is bring people together. You know, this the idea that we can't ever agree on things and that people have to divide up into partisan camps is just lame to me. That Brooks gets it. It's just as important to him as it is to anyone else that people in Oakland County live healthy lives. You know, we have HIV/AIDS in Oakland County and Pontiac and in Ferndale and the other towns. So, we need to bring people together, regardless of whether they're conservative or liberal. You asked about condoms. Condoms is one example. It's one way to reduce risk if, let's say, someone is sexually active. Other ways, of course, would be to abstain from sexual activity, because HIV is transmitted to a large extent. Most of the cases around the world are because of sexual behavior. It's no different than any other sexually transmitted infection. And so intercourse is what is the mode of transmission in most cases. Drug use as well, if you're sharing needles or there's any kind of blood-to-blood contact. It's not that easy of a disease to catch. If someone's sitting next to you on the bus, you're not going to get infected from HIV. But postponing sexual behavior, as I said, being in a one-on-one relationship with someone who you know is also, you know, HIV negative, that's another way to prevent the spread. But if someone is sexually active and they have more than one partner, then condoms are, if used properly, very effective at preventing STIs, gonorrhea, syphilis, HIV.
Well, one of the things I have here is the Michigan AIDS facts, and it seems, even with the problem with the ongoing infections, to a large extent in terms of information and slowing the progress, and tell me if I'm wrong in this, Craig Covey, that at least seems to be we have a handle on this, whereas in the rest of the world, it seems in so many areas almost out of control. I was just horrified by the fact sheet here as well in South Africa, how in almost 20 years that the life expectancy in South Africa in 1990 was 62, and by 2005 it had fallen to 46 years.
Sure. What's happened in each country is unique, but most of the world has gone through a phase of denial. I mean, the story of HIV/AIDS is a story of denial that when it first appeared, people said, oh, that's not going to affect me. That's just affecting gay men who live in New York, or that's just affecting Haitian immigrants. When it got more prevalent, people in the UP said, oh, that's not a problem up here. It's a Detroit problem. It has been a story of denial. And even today in China and in India, two of the most populated countries in the world, there is some extent of denial where the government is not paying attention. They don't want to talk about it. And that's when the disease spreads so quickly. So in South Africa, I've seen regions there where the infection rate is upwards of 30%, one out of three adults already infected. When that happens, what you need to do, of course, is not only get the education, you want to protect the next generation, the teenagers and the children, and you want to get the medications to the adults. You know, people, when this epidemic began, people would pass away very quickly. People would get the disease. The symptoms would show up, and they could die within 6 months to 2 years. We have the medications now that keep people healthier and alive. They're expensive, and so that's why you have these much larger numbers in these third world countries. I want to share with you why one of the reasons the Tappers, the jewelers, besides being philanthropic and wanting to help people, 90% of the world's platinum and a large percentage of the world's, you know, gold and diamonds come from South Africa. And the mining companies lose upwards of 12% of their workers every year. Imagine going to work and knowing, looking around and knowing that one out of eight of those employees will die in the next year. Huge amounts of problems and turmoil and distress. So the funding that we're raising at this gala on December 1st, a small portion of it stays here in Michigan and goes to MAP, my agency, but the lion's share is going to South Africa, this organization called Youth AIDS, and it's an AIDS relief organization. But they actually work with the young people and the children and the teenagers, educating them, and the goal is to protect this next generation.
Yeah, and you can go to youthaids.com, which will give you more information about all of this, as well as aidsprevention.org. That's the MAP website?
Correct.
It? Yeah. I just saw these figures that the White House called speculative, although they didn't deny them, that the war in Iraq, the war in occupation, eventually, with all the costs involved, will be an expenditure for the American taxpayer of over $2 trillion. Yet, when MAP is having spaghetti dinners in Ferndale in order to allow people suffering from AIDS to keep their pets, I mean, there's something wrong here. Obviously, if Craig Covey could have all the money that was available for this misadventure in the Middle East, what would that solve the problem? Could you solve the problem worldwide with the billions and billions of dollars?
Well, you know, money isn't 100% of the solution, but it sure could help. And if I were in, you know, I guess I'm sort of in charge of Ferndale, a little four-square-mile town now with other council members, but if I were running things, they would be run a lot different. It's tempting to go on about the huge, huge waste that the war, but yeah, healthcare seems like a logical way to use resources as opposed to destroying a country, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, speaking of Ferndale, I forgot. You should tell people about the, is my memory here? Alternatives? Is that the brand-new building?
Affirmations.
Affirmations. Hello. Okay. Thank you.
Region's, largest gay-lesbian community center after about a three-year capital project. They were able to raise $5 million and built not only a really, really nice, cool community center in downtown Ferndale, but it's LEED certified, meaning that it is a green building, which is the way of the future. This building uses a variety of ways to cut energy costs and not be so devastating on the environment. So that's kind of neat. It's a green building, meaning they don't waste energy and power.
Well, we just have about 30 seconds left. As I said, you're the mayor-elect of Ferndale. Anything we will notice different in the next year or so?
What we want to do in Ferndale is survive this recession. We're all in the same boat. Hopefully, we'll all be rowing in the same direction. I'm real excited and optimistic. People were ready to write off Ferndale a decade ago. They were willing to write off the state, you know, the Rust Belt state and unemployment. I'm optimistic. We have smart people. We've got a great climate. We got water here in Michigan. We have great universities. You keep your eyes on Ferndale. The property values are going to go up again, and our downtown is going to gleam and sparkle, and we're just trying to show the region some new ways to do things.
Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Mayor-elect Craig Covey of Ferndale. You can, in terms of what we were talking about, the gala on World AIDS Day, December 1st, you can go to tappers.com. A lot more information about the subject of HIV/AIDS at aidsprevention.org. Craig Covey, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, thanks for being a part of the solution.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every Weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks.
WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think all of us are environmentalists now, aren't we? We all know that there is global warming, that that there is a problem from what humans have done through the petrochemical nuclear industrial society, and many of us are good in good environmentalists. We recycle, we put in the right light bulbs, and we do all that. I sure do. Well, is that enough? I'm looking at a book. It's called As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. Derek Jensen is the author, along with cartoonist, graphic novelist Stephanie McMillan. Derek Jensen has joined us before on the Peter Werby Show. His writing has been described by Publishers Weekly as breaking and mending the reader's heart. He's an activist, a philosopher. He's the author of Endgame. That was an enormous two-volume work on the predicament that he feels, and many of us feels, that we are currently in. Probably his best-known book is A Language Other Than Words and the Culture of Make-Believe. Derek Jensen joins us from Northern California. Derek, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, let me see. There's a book missing in here, though, that I interviewed you about that I didn't mention, and it's out of my mind. Do you remember the one?
Is it Strangely Like War, Welcome to the Machine, Walking on Water?
Yes, Strangely Like War. So you're quite prolific. You list yourself as an activist first and a philosopher second. One would think Derek Jensen probably is an author and a philosopher first. Is there a distinction, or does the rank order of that make any difference?
Oh, that's a great point, and nobody's ever asked me that before. And I do consider myself an activist first because the writing is a means to an end. I'm not simply trying to write to pad my book list, although that's always kind of a fun thing to do. But instead, I want to achieve change in the real physical world. And there's a great line by Brecht, I think, which is, art is not a mirror to reflect the world, but rather a hammer to shape it.
Hmm.
And this is my weapon of choice. That's not my weapon of choice. It's the weapon that I'm best at is words. And it's like Artie Lang has one of the best first lines of any book I ever read in his book, The Politics of Experience, which is, few books today are forgivable. And his point is that we are so alienated and so separated from our bodies, from ourselves, from the world around us, that any book that doesn't begin with that alienation and attempt to rectify it is not forgivable. You'd be better off with blank words on a page. I mean, I'm sorry, with blank pages in a book.
Yeah. Well, Derek Jensen, when you listed here as a philosopher, would it be fair to say you're an environmental philosopher? I mean, a lot of people, when they think of philosophy, you might be thinking, what is reality or something like that, which is not an unimportant question. But
it's amazing you bring that up, because that actually is the question I'm writing about right now, and not in a sort of philosophical way. Somebody asked me what I think of philosophers at a talk I did just recently, and I sort of made the universal masturbation symbol, that I just think philosophy is just so much of it is such a waste of time. But I'm going to talk about this what is real question in a way I think that is not a waste of time, which is, when we talk about, for example, all the solutions that we always hear about for global warming or any of these other crises, but let's take global warming in specific, that when we hear about those, the thing that they all have in common is that they all take this culture as a given, as what they're trying to save, as what is real, and they take the natural world as secondary. And that's all wrong, because it's like, I was doing a radio interview down in Santa Barbara maybe 6 months ago, and this applies right to this point. And it was a horrible interview. It was by this right-wing, anti-environmental, property rights uber Allah's Bible thumper. And he just basically wanted an environmentalist to yell at. So I'm talking about how 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and how there's 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the oceans, and how there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And he kept saying to me, Derek, that's all fine. Get back in the real world.
Hmm.
And what he meant by the real world was industrial capitalism. It's like, if two kids are in college and one says, yeah, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? What he really means is, what are you going to do when you get out into the wage economy? That's not the real world. The real world, it's like, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real physical world. And so long as...
Wait. What, I don't get that. Roll around in the dirt. What do you mean?
Oh, just that the dirt is the real world. I mean, the trees are the real world.
Okay.
Soil is the real world.
All right. Okay.
The real world. Okay. Industrial capitalism is a social construct. And that doesn't mean it's not all over the place, because it is, but it's still a social construct. The real physical world, you know, hammerhead sharks, jellyfish, the Great Lakes, those aren't constructs. Those are the real world. And what people forget is that a social construct must be secondary to the real world. It must conform to the real world, because the real world determines whether you live or die. Because without a real world, you don't have a social construct, because you don't have anything. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is that it's so embarrassing to say this, it's so obvious that without a land base, you die. I mean, the people who come after us are not going to care about, you know, whether we wrote really good books. That's why I'm not just a writer. They're not going to care about whether we wrote really good books. They're not going to care if we did really great radio programs. They're not going to care about if we were good activists, whether we voted, whether we didn't vote, who we voted for. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. Because we can all fantasize about some really great eco-socialist utopia with free love for everybody. And if you can't breathe the air, it doesn't matter.
That's true. Derek Jensen is my guest. He has written the words for a graphic novel, As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. A graphic novel, we kind of used to call them comics, but now it's a graphic novel. They're much more, if you haven't seen it, they're book size, and they express what would have been in a written novel, just words on a page, with a graphic form. Stephanie McMillan did that. Derek Jensen, after this enormous book that you published, Endgame, suddenly a graphic novel. Is this Derek Jensen light? Sorry.
I don't know if it's Derek Jensen light. I mean, it does present a lot of the same ideas and some new ones. And it's certainly a smaller book and it has less words. And you can read this, you know, in a couple evenings. part of it is that I like messing around with all these different forms. And I've written a couple of novels that are, there's a publisher very interested in them right now. And I've written a couple plays that never went anywhere. So I really enjoy messing around with all these different forms. It is, I guess, a bit of a, but, you know, I'm really pleased with it because we were able to get all the, as well as making a plot that I think is really interesting and having a bunch of really good jokes, we also were able to get across a lot of the philosophies that we were trying to get across, both me and Stephanie.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the end game, as I said, this very large two-volume set that is engaging. I mean, it doesn't feel like, I mean, when you first look at it, you go, you know, this is going to take me months or something like that. But the ideas that you present are engaging, that it drives you along. And yet, this is something, I mean, I could imagine saying to somebody, here, read Derek Jensen's Endgame, and they go, you know, just kind of being overwhelmed by the size. But in many ways, this is a popular form, the graphic novel, and has the ability to, in the sort of precise meaning of the word propaganda, to propagate ideas the way movements always have in the past, to be able to present things in a way that can be understood by great numbers of people. So they both work, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, thanks. And, you know, that's that's exactly right. And one of the things that we can do with the graphic novel form that I couldn't do otherwise is you can really, I mean, the whole thing is a satire, and it's, you know, so we took a lot of characters and we made them more extreme. I mean, for example, in here, the president basically just, I mean, some space aliens come down from outer space and they want to consume the planet, and they go to the president, and gold is one of their waste products, and they hand him a whole ton of gold, so he gives them permits to consume the world is one of the things that happens. And I mean, that's just nice and silly and fun, and at the same time, that's fundamentally how things go, that if a government issues a permit for something, even though it's immoral and insane and everything else, once it's permitted, it's like there's no way you can stop it. And so we were just trying to really, and of course the way things get permitted is that instead of them handing over gold, you know, the lobbyists hand over lots of money to the governmental, you know, to the president or the senator or whatever. And so we were just able to really spoof that point, that's actually a very serious point about how this whole system works, that somebody rich pays the legislators, and then the legislators pass a law making it so this rich person can do basically whatever they want to.
No matter how injurious it is to the planet. On the back of your book, As the World Burns, it says this is a wake-up call that will inspire you to do whatever it takes to stop ecocide, in other words, the destruction of the environment, before it's too late. Now, when I introduced you, I said that we're all environmentalists. We all know we have to recycle. We all know we have to use those fluorescent bulbs. We all know we shouldn't throw our used motor oil in down the sewer. So, and maybe, that you're talking about that right-winger in Santa Barbara, maybe he was saying, look, you're being a little too dire, Derek Jensen. We've got a consciousness now that can solve the problems we're facing.
he wasn't saying that, because one of the last things he said to me is, Derek, it's very clear that you don't have, what was the word he said?
A solution?
You don't have a... No. He said, it's very clear, you don't have an appreciation for the fact that God gave man dominion over the earth.
Okay, let's move on from him. All right, here I am. I'm a good, I'm a nice white middle-class American. I recycle. I try to consume less than, consume consciously, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I've got fluorescent light bulbs. So we're on our way to saving the planet, and you're still saying things are going to hell.
Well, they are. I mean, as I said earlier, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And there was recently a study showing that whippoorwill populations have gone down by 80% and in the last 40 years. And the point is that there was that they got a quote from the head of Audubon, who used to be the head of the EPA, and her quote was that this isn't an emergency. And it's like, wait a second. This goes back to the question, what is real again? Whippoorwill populations go down by 80%. That's not an emergency. What if the United States gross domestic product went down by 80% in 40 years? The press would bray that that's an emergency. And the point is that what do we consider real? And, okay, but now back to you. The whole compact fluorescent thing, I mean, sure, I think people should recycle, but I don't think people should kid themselves that that's sufficient. And it's as the logicians say, necessary but not sufficient. And it's, like Al Gore's movie, at the end of the movie, they list a bunch of solutions that people can do. And I have a couple problems with them. The first one is that all of the solutions have to do with what individuals can do. But individuals aren't the real problem. The real problem is corporations and governments. They're the real actors. And it all points it away from where the real action is. And that has us take. It's like, it's really horrible that we end up taking responsibility and feeling guilty over what we do when we're not the major problem. Here's a really good example of that is water usage. That people say, oh, take shorter showers, et cetera, et cetera. 90% of the water used by human beings on the planet is used for agriculture and industry. And the same amount of water is used for municipal golf courses as is used for municipal human beings. So if I take a shorter shower, all it's going to do is, mess with my social life. It's not going to make a bit of difference so long as there still exist golf courses, semiconductor factories. Those are the real hogs of water. And it's the same with a lot of other things. ExxonMobil, all by itself, has put out, I think, 5% of all greenhouse gases over the last 100 and some years. And, I mean, I live pretty simply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. I'm not making a political statement. And that's not, once again, I'm not saying that we should, individually just go, consume more just for the heck of it. But what I'm saying is we should in no way let ourselves be convinced that is sufficient. So anyway, back to Al Gore's movie. At the end of the movie, he makes a bunch of suggestions. And, people should inflate their tires and buy compact fluorescents and everything else. And a friend of mine who knows a lot about global warming, he made a film, actually, about global warming and peak oil, What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire. He did the math for me. Ends up, if every single person in the United States did everything that Al Gore is talking about, it would reduce emissions in the United States by, I think, 22, 23%. And, well, that would be great.
Which would be good, yeah.
two things. One is that since we all still live within this economy that's based on growth on a finite planet, all of that loss, all of that cutback on greenhouse gases would be covered up again by the increase in gross domestic product within a few years.
Sure.
And then the other part of it is that the pretty much consensus these days, scientific consensus, is that in order to avert even further catastrophe, we really need to reduce emissions by about 80%. And so my point is that even with everything he suggests, if every single person in the United States did those, it would still be grossly insufficient.
Yeah, well, I think most people forget that the triad, which involves recycle, that recycle is the absolute last. It's reduce, reuse, recycle. The main one being reduce, which, as you said, the necessity of industrial capitalism to always expand wealth accumulation, looking at that for anyone in that world is they would see that as suicide. Then to reuse what we can, and what's left over is to be recycled. And we, at that point, we should examine why are we producing something that has to be recycled? Because recycling is extraordinarily toxic, isn't it?
Oh, it can be, yeah. And I also want to jump in on the word we. That
okay, that's good.
You know, I'm not actually producing all these things. I think this is really important to separate ourselves. In one way, in some ways, in other ways not, but in some ways I think it really is. And a great example of this is a friend of mine called me up a while ago and said, "Hey, Derek, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq?" And I looked around and I said, "We're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California." And she said, "Okay, Derek, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq?" I said, "I got troops?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, will they do what I tell them?" And she said, "Yeah, this is why I only talk to you once every 6 weeks," you know, hung up. And the point is that it's really important to recognize that we aren't, you know, driving this vehicle. Oh, great example of this is that I was on a panel in Erie, Pennsylvania about a month and a half ago or something, and there were four of us, me, Vandana Shiva, Kathy Pedler, and a nun whose name I can never remember. She was great. Anyway, we're all talking up there about how we don't live in a democracy, and none of us believe it's a democracy. Nobody in the audience believed it was a democracy. We're all, you know, it's a government by and for the corporations, and we all agree on that. And then the nun was saying that she was talking about all the tactics that they're using to try to stop the war in Iraq. And I said, okay, how would it change your tactics if you really internalize the understanding that we don't live in a democracy? Because you've been saying we don't live in a democracy. But now when it comes to your tactics that you want to use to try to stop the war, they all end up being about appealing to the leaders in this non-democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so how would your tactics change? And she said, yeah, that's a really good question. We need to think about that. And so that's why I think it's really important to think about this whole we thing. You know, Walmart producing something is not me producing something or you producing something.
I agree. I think the distinction is important. The book is As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. It's a graphic novel. Derek Jensen, my guest, has written the words, and Stephanie McMillan has drawn the very, very sharp graphics for it all. Well, one of the things that you're getting at, of course, is that we've done everything possible within a democratic society. We've assembled for redress of grievances, we've used the free press, and we've used freedom of speech, and we talk about the Constitution being shredded, which it is in many ways, but still, we actually have more freedom this time around than the kind of government repression that occurred during the Vietnam War, and certainly the horrible repression that occurred, for instance, during World War One and the opposition to that. If recycling doesn't do it, and if the fluorescent bulbs don't do it, and voting in the Democrats certainly doesn't do it, what the hell do we do? And I'm sorry, I don't know, if you would have asked me that, I would have said same thing.
Yeah. Well, I think what the first thing we need to do is come up with a framework for solutions, and the framework for solutions is recognizing that the real physical world is primary. And that's where you get your food from. See, that's part of the problem, too, is that if your experience or my experience or anybody's experience is their food comes from the grocery store and their water comes from a tap, they're going to defend to the death the system that brings all of those to them. as opposed to if your experience, not your thought, not your philosophy, not your feelings about it, but your experience. But if your experience is that your food comes from the land and your water comes from a river, you know, people used to drink from rivers. How quaint is that?
Yeah.
And if that's your experience, you'll defend to the death those because your life depends on it. And so that's part of the problem is that we have been made dependent upon a system that is exploiting us and exploiting everyone.
And it's an artificial system. As you said, I mean, it's not. It's partly a social construct, but it's also a physical construct.
Yeah.
And so we now, of course, if this physical construct stopped operating, as we see, for instance, we keep talking about Iraq, we see what happens there when the physical infrastructure is destroyed by war and occupation, the misery that those folks are suffering, even without the all the deaths.
Well,
go ahead.
That's part of it. But on the other hand, I mean, there is. I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And one of the examples that she gave is that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe.
Huh.
And so there are people starving to death in India, lots of people starving because of the global economy. So, two things. One is that, so obviously if the global economy disappeared tomorrow, which would be the best thing for the planet, of course, people in the United States would be worse off. Urban people would be worse off. Rural people would not particularly be worse off. Rural people in the third world would be better off immediately. I mean, what is it? And that's the thing. We talk about we again. We talk about even humans, you know, having... what would happen if the whole system changed? I don't know what the numbers are, but when I usually give numbers, they're real, but I'm going to just make this up, and it's somewhere in the ballpark. It's like half the people in the world or something have no access to electricity already. So if the electrical infrastructure disappeared, they would immediately be no worse off and probably better because the rich would not be able to steal from them. I mean, there's the thing. We all know that whenever there's a famine in any country, almost always, I think this is 70%, and that number's right within about 10%. 70% of them are food exporters, net food exporters. It's just that so they're starving. It's just like with the water. People aren't dying of thirst because there's no water. They're dying of thirst because the water is being taken for agriculture and industry. And it's the same with food, that they're not starving because the... I mean, it's like people talk, I'm jumping topics again, but, you know, this is how I think and how I work, that, you know, people talk about, you know, illegal immigrants, and they want to close the border to Mexico. And I always say, sure, fine, close the border to Mexico on one condition, which is you close it not only to people but also to resources. Because if you're saying you want to close it to people but not resources, what you're saying is, I don't want you, but I want coffee that's grown on land that used to be yours. I mean, the people are coming up to the United States not because they want to take eco-tours of the San Joaquin Valley. You know, they're coming up because they've been dispossessed. And it's the same with the starvation for the people who remain. The reason that they're starving is because the land has been expropriated and is now being used for cash crops for export.
Well, the subtitle of your graphic novel is 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial, and getting fluorescent light bulbs ain't going to do it, as you've indicated. But then... What the solution seems so far from realization that one barely knows what to do. I find myself, of course, as an activist taking part in environmental reform, you know, acting against the worst that the system is putting forth, like putting an open burn incinerator in the middle of Detroit, you know, something like that. So, I mean, that's just a sort of reflexive self-protection. But it's hard to kind of know what to do from this point on.
Well, on the smallest scale... I'm not a big believer in the reform versus revolution question. We need it all. You know, on the small scale, people should do everything. They should recycle. They should, do activism, just as you're saying. They should prevent the worst of the things from happening. And on the big scale, we all know, too, that if all we have is reform, then this culture is going to continue to grind away until there's nothing left, until it collapses. And on the other hand, if we all just wait for the great, glorious revolution... then there won't be anything left to save. So we need it all. We need to bring down this whole system that's killing the planet. And at the same time, we also need to do these defenses of the places we love. And, I mean, here's the thing. Is this culture, this way of living is not going to last. You can't consume a planet and live on it. And so our lives depend upon stopping this culture from killing everything that is.
Derek, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Derek Jensen. His latest book is a graphic novel. He wrote the words. Stephanie McMillan did the wonderful comics. And Ted Rall, a famous cartoonist, said, "A visionary and honest as the world burns offers a compelling yet brutal assessment of the state of the planet." Thanks so much for being with us on the Peter Werbe Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to WRIF.com.